kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining me, Cole Martin. How are you doing?
I'm alive! Whee!
Yay!
I don't sound quite as bad as I did last week.
No, and I'm sounding worse.
Yeah, it's your turn now.
Yes.
I hope you enjoy the upper respiratory infection. I'm all out of antibiotics because I'm good and I took all mine.
Oh, God. Well, American healthcare is not going to help us anyway, so we got to call someone from out of the country to help us out with this. And the professionals of all things pharmaceuticals and video games, we're bringing in Andrew James of Uppercut Games. Andrew, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. Good morning. Good morning and good day. I have to say that.
Oh, yeah. Is that a legal requirement that you have to say good day?
Yeah, pretty much.
So how are you doing today?
Good. I've just got into the office here. It's about 10 in the morning. And, you know, we're launching a game, like, tomorrow and the next day and the next day.
You're launching a game? That is a crazy coincidence because we're on a video game podcast. Tell us, what is this game that you are launching?
It's called City of Brass. So it's an Arabian Nights-inspired sort of action-adventure roguelike type game. There you go. First person.
So first person, action-adventure, roguelike, and hard. That is what I can confirm. This game is not a hand-holding game.
Joe has adventures with gatekeepers.
Oh, God.
Right. Yeah, you have to tell me about those. I'm sure that was fun.
Oh, my God. Oh, the friggin' gatekeepers. Anyway, let's jump right to it. For the people who don't know what City of Brass is, give us the elevator pitch.
So you play as a thief who has discovered an amulet that gives you access to this city that has been hidden in the sands for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, and the residents of this city have been cursed by genies who they enslaved. Your job, once you go into the city, you're stuck. Everybody there's cursed. You're cursed never to leave, so you have to try to fight your way to the center of the city and break the curse, free yourself, get the great prize that's awaiting you there. And, that's your goal. So it's set in Arabian Nights. So you've got a sword and a whip. They're the two tools. So the whip is the thing that we really worked on in this game. We wanted to, it's sort of the distinctive feature that makes it sort of feel different to everything else and play differently. So you've got this, the whip isn't really a weapon, but you use it to manipulate the world, use it to trip enemies and stun them and pick things up. And we wanted it to be, it's like a multi-tool. It's kind of like our gravity gun or something like that.
It is very satisfying to use as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's a word we like to hear, satisfying. Yeah, we spent a lot of time on, the very core of the idea just came from two things that came together in a bunch of conversations. And one was, how cool Indiana Jones is when he's like doing cool stuff with his whip that isn't really actually possible. All of that stuff he does is like, it's just not even, you can't even do that in reality. And the other thing was the really cool combat mechanics from the Bioshock games with, we've got like Electro Bolt, which is this thing that sort of is a semi-ranged weapon that sort of stuns things. And then you had the wrench. So you had this melee weapon, you had this range thing, and you could use them in combination with sort of a cadence and a rhythm to that combat. So we wanted to mash those two ideas, sort of came together in a game concept, which became City of Brass.
I am absolutely loving my time with the game so far, and satisfying is just another word that comes to mind when I think of the combat. It for me, I'm bad at video games sometimes, and this is one that, like, I know there's a heavy focus on moving quickly and, speed running and taking care of enemies back to back to back and just a good flow to the combat and to the movement. And I'm bad at that. So when I have those moments where everything is just connecting and I do a slide into a room and I hit the one skeleton that's right in front of me and then I turn to my left and whip an urn that explodes and kills two more guys, that is, again, just satisfying on the rare times that I personally am able to make that happen.
Yeah, well, I'm actually there with you. I'm probably the worst person in the studio at playing our game. You know, on the leaderboards, I'm the guy at the bottom. But,
I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to be down there.
We spent a lot of time just trying to get that core movement and the interaction mechanics. You know, there's some things there that people initially find that maybe it feels a bit awkward compared to a normal first-person game. So the movement's a little bit slower when you're just walking around, and the sword has got a bit of a delay on it. But that's all there to sort of make you learn this sort of rhythm, and then once you get into that rhythm, that's when it actually sort of, you know, that's the payoff, is that you sort of get into this the rhythm of the combat, and you start sort of pulling off these combinations, and you know, there's a lot of inspiration taken at the start when we first started making it from Spelunky, where there was a bunch of things that cascade. You know, you do one thing and another thing would happen, and you get a sort of cascade of events. So that's where we got some of the ideas of trying to make the environment, you know, sort of a tool in the game, as well as just like hitting enemies with a stick, right?
Which works too.
The environment is just as useful at taking out the enemies as either the sword or the whip can be. Like, if you place it just right, you're going to trigger, you know, like the urn that'll explode, and then even the ones that don't catch fire will get knocked back into some other kind of environmental trap, like the abyss where they'll fall, or the pits or whatever. So it's incredibly satisfying, not just to you know, take out the enemies head on yourself, but to just kind of plan how you're going to create a domino effect with your attack, which I can do. Joe probably can't because he's bad at games.
I just think it's cute that you said plan, and I'm there like, it's, for me, it's a happy accident. When it happens, it's fantastic, but
I've stood in the doorway of the doors and just like looked at the placement of the enemies and been like, okay, if I throw a pot here, that's going to trigger this to happen. But, you know, I did have to adjust, where you mentioned, AJ, that the movement is slower and the timing for the sword is on a delay. I did have to adjust for that because I'm so used to running in, say, on Immortal Redneck, which I've been playing the mess out of lately. You just run like, you know, run like mad and just go through and shoot everything. And you can't really, like, even though there's a speed running aspect to City of Brass, you want to slow down and take a moment and just be like, two throws of a pot and I can clear a whole room.
Right, and that's the way I play as well. I don't have the reflexes in my old man hands to you know, to pull off the sort of speed running, you know, sliding, jumping, whipping sort of maneuvering. So I have to play it sort of methodically as well. You know, like, sort of, if I whip that guy in the face, then I can whip that guy in the legs, and I can run over and push him, and pulling. You know, you can pull with the whip and shove. So there's that sort of combination of manipulating the enemies and hopefully not actually having to get too close to them, and just you want to really go in there and just finish them off with the sword and not take too much damage yourself.
That's the same way I've been playing. I'm like, I will stand back here, I will knock your sword out of your hand, and then I'll deal with you.
Right,
but I'm not taking anybody on head on.
there's definitely a learning process. I was at PAX East recently watching people pick the game up and play it, and you know, everyone runs in, tries to just sort of do the Rambo approach and they get their ass kicked. And then they go, right, okay, there's a bit of sort of strategy here in terms of the moment-to-moment combat. I have to think about it a bit more.
Which is it, because where it is a roguelike, you can't just, you know, memorize those kind of attacks either. It's different every time.
Yeah, definitely. But what you can build up is like a strategy for each enemy, and each combination. So if there's a guy with the shield there, and you know, you can maybe slide in and knock him over, or he can pull his shield back, or you could just throw the fire at him so you don't have to deal with him directly, things like that.
Throwing is my favorite strategy in the game. If there's something near me that I could pick up and throw at some motherfucker's head, that's what I'm going to do, because I could do that away from them and I don't have to worry about a skeleton like shoulder charging into me and knocking out a bunch of my health.
That system started as like a rock, like a pebble you could pick up. I think we just had the pebble and and you could throw it, and we're like, oh, we'll just put these, you know, we don't want this to be a big thing, and we'll just put them sparingly around the world. And then I think we put the explosive urn in next, and then we're okay, but this is too much fun. No, put them every 3 meters on the ground.
So what other kind of fun throwables are in here? We have the exploding jugs. We have the vases. I ran into a poisonous one. There's the lanterns that you could chuck at people. What other fun things can you throw at people in this game?
There's a few other things. There's an enemy later in the game whose head you can throw at people.
Yes.
Once you kill them, you can pick their heads up. I'm trying to think now. What else do we have? I think that's about it. There's maybe 5 or 6 different throwables. And there's a few others coming, you know, in updates that didn't quite make it into the 1.0 version, but they're sort of waiting in the wings. Just need a little bit more work.
All I needed to hear was that you could throw someone's head at other people. Yeah. That makes me so, so happy.
Yeah, it's a satisfying thing to do. Because not only did you kill them, also, this guy's is a trick to it, to killing them too. So, once you work that out, it's like a little prize. You know, it's a reward.
Joe is never gonna kill him and get the reward.
Probably not. I'm proud of myself because I made it past the first gatekeeper today. I was so excited. I made it all the way up to stage 6 today.
Oh,
so
nice.
I feel proud of myself.
Yeah, I think I made it to 7.
Shut up.
Yeah.
You got past the second gatekeeper. Yeah, she's.
I did.
She's
hard.
You're mean. Making
the first
fun
time
me.
I entered, I was just running in a circle, going, I don't know what to do.
So how were you playing the game? Were you going jumping ahead through the portals once you unlocked them to then sort of just get the feeling for the next stage, or were you playing it like the hardcore roguelike way of starting right at the start and going through each time?
I have hardcore roguelike it. I have not taken any of the portals.
Okay.
I feel like it's better to go the long way and collect all the shit I can. I need all the extra help I can get.
Yeah, it's definitely good when you can collect extra shit.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cool shit to pick up in this game too.
Yeah, and when you get to that harder levels, you really want to have more items and equipment.
Tell us about some of the cool items and equipment that you can get in this game.
So the player always has a sword. You always have a melee weapon, so it could be a sword or a club. You start with a scimitar, and you always have a whip. But there's a bunch of different ones you can switch in and out. There's a whip that burns things and freezes. Another one freezes things, and there's like sort of double knockback and one that slows enemies down. So they're like sort of modifiers on what the whip can do, but you're still using it to sort of keep the enemy at bay. And then you've got the different melee weapons, and there's a range of armors as well. So there's those three things that are they're like a slot. So you've always got armor, always got the whip and the melee weapon, and then there's this whole range of items called relics, and they stack. So you can theoretically you can get every relic in the game on a single run through. I don't know whether that's even possible with the with the way the economy works, but it could be, I guess. So they stack, so you can just pick up as many as you want, and they all have just like a slightly different effect on the player. They might make you run faster or be quiet, take the sound off your feet so you can be more stealthy. There's an invisibility cloak. You can actually sort of build out a almost a stealth character with not making any sound, and there's a invisibility cloak and a backstab double damage relic. So you can put those together, or you can make like a speed running loadout, which is like, I'm going to jump twice as high and run twice as fast. And, those modifiers just sort of stack up to sort of create a slightly different playthrough each time, depending on what you buy from the store, from the genies.
Do you have any favorite items? Because I'm personally a big fan of, the Ring of Attraction or whatever it is that makes all the gold come to you. Yeah. I love that one.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think my favorite one is the Flaming Whip, just because you can just burn things from the distance.
Yeah.
And burn everything.
That's a good one, too. I like that one. What about you, Cole? What are some of your favorite items in the game?
I like the Frost Whip. That's probably my favorite. I do like the Ring of Attraction, too, because I kind of get shiny object syndrome, and I just think everything that's shiny should be picked up. So if I've got the Ring of Attraction, I can just walk over after I've busted all the vases, and it just tells me you can have this one and you can't have that one, yeah. Which is good. Otherwise, I'm sitting there going, let me pick this vase up, and that's bad.
Yeah, I'm a collector as well. I have to pick everything up. I can't leave the room unless every pot is smashed.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the worst thief ever, though, because like I spend all my money. As soon as I see a genie that's a store, I'm like, oh, give me all the things. Just make it easier for me. Give me everything. And then I'll walk away and I'll be like, fuck, I'm broke.
Yeah, you just have to go hunting for more loot then.
Yeah, that's all I need is to go spend more time breaking more vases.
So, Cole, it's good that you brought up genies. AJ, do you want to tell us, what do the genies do in this game?
So these genies have been enslaved in the fiction. They've been enslaved in the city. Excuse me. So they're doing a job. Some of them sell items. Some of them will. One of them will turn traps off. Another guy will sell you health back. And another. There's one that spawns a companion who'll fight for you. And so there's. I think there's 11 different genies. There's a bunch of helpful genies and there's a couple of not so helpful genies. They're the red ones.
Dickhead genies.
Yeah, those guys. So they're basically like sentries in the city, and they're trying to help protect the loot. So you can use the genies. Each genie has, because it's a Arabian Nights story, you have three wishes, and you can use. So every time you start the game, you've got three wishes. And you can use those on three of these 11 different genies, and that actually basically modifies what they do. If you use it on the shop, he'll give you better, more rare items. He'll basically show you, he's like, here's the stuff I had out the back, you know, here's the good stuff. And if you use your wish on the turret genie, the guy who hurls the fireballs, you know, he'll actually become your ally and attack the enemies. But obviously, you've only got three, so each time you play through, you might want to use a different strategy.
I've run into the issue where I always use my wishes on the same genies. The first one to give me health, because instead of just buying one heart, I could fill up all my health for a higher cost. And then I save the other two for whatever evil genies I run into, because I don't want a genie chucking fireballs at my face or summoning skeletons to fight against me forever. So I save my other wishes to just bribe them instead.
Yeah, so like some people don't like the trap. You know, the traps, you can use one wish to disable the traps too.
I disable the traps every floor.
Right.
Bye, traps.
I don't mind the traps too much. I think a lot of them are easy enough to see that you don't have to worry too much about, you know, getting caught by a bunch of them. Every now and then you'll find that trap door right before a door that you need to get through that you'll forget about and just fall down in and die and ruin all your progress.
Oops. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's good to get rid of all the traps.
The getting rid of the traps is cheap, though. It's only like 250, 300. It goes up a little as you, you know, progress.
But true.
Yeah, and if like you use the wish, I think it does the whole stage for you.
Yeah, like I know I said I buy everything from the shop, but I will always save money to disable the traps. And I don't care if I'm already at the end, I'm still hitting that one.
just on principle, turn those traps off.
I actually got one of the turn all the trap off genies right in the very last room before the exit. And I'm just sitting there looking at the guy like, really? You couldn't show up a couple of rooms earlier?
He was just put there to taunt you. Yeah.
The procedural generation aspect, though.
Hey, and there's the dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah, they never fail. They never fail.
If you heard some creaking in the background earlier, that was as Evan came in, one of the programmers here at the Uppercut. I'm in a big open space. We just have one big room. It's our studio.
Nice. So I love the fact that you have coworkers that are going to make noise, as well as a construction area behind you. Cole, you have your dogs. And then apparently my landlord has decided to start cutting the grass at 8:30 at night. Like, what the hell? Everyone is going to have to deal with noise tonight, I guess. I closed my window. I don't know if any of the noise is going to bleed through or not, but I guess we'll find out in time, huh?
I don't hear any background noise, but I'm also on a phone, so.
Yeah, that helps, too.
I hear nothing.
So, AJ, you mentioned that you showed this off at PAX East recently. Do you have any fun stories of people who played the game and were either, like, really, really good at it and blew you guys away, or people who were just absolutely awful, like us?
So there was the thing that blew me away, there was a couple of kids. A guy came in with his son and his son's mate. I think they looked about 12. And, you know, this kid's, like, sort of reaching up to get to the laptop keys. He was quite short, and he was just smashing it. He was the best player of the whole show. He just picked it up straight away. Yeah, amazing reflexes. The kids are so much better at the games than us. You know, like, half the team here were over 40. Yeah, and there was another guy who was in a stand next to us, and he really liked the game, and he kept coming back. But every time he played, he got worse. And he's like, "I'll have one more go," and he'd try again, and he'd die sooner and sooner. He's like, "It just got worse and worse and worse." As the show went on.
Did he eventually get to the point where he, like, died in the very first room to the trap?
Not quite that bad, but if he had kept going, he probably would have got there.
How many times did he play?
Oh, maybe, I think, 5 or 6 times, yeah.
And he got worse every time. That's actually really impressive.
I think he was getting pretty frustrated.
I think what tends to happen with roguelike type games is that you have beginner's luck on your side the first couple runs. You don't know what to expect, and so you're always just, like, on guard. And then after you start to learn the mechanics and you know what you're doing, then you just get careless and you do dumb shit.
Yeah, yeah. I had that experience with Dead Cells. I was playing that, and I had this awesome run and unlocked a set of really awesome gear, and I was going through, and then the next, like, 5 times I played, it's just like, what? I can't even get past the first level.
Oh, God. Mm-hmm.
So, speaking of the roguelike and procedural generation aspects of it, how does developing that kind of world differ, and what kind of challenges does it pose compared to some of the other games you've developed and released?
Well, actually, the reason we started looking at procedural was actually almost a knee-jerk reaction from making Submerged. So that was... Mm-hmm. This massive city. We've still got the same team, so we had 6 people. So there's 2 artists and 1 designer and 3 coders. And so John and I, the other artists, we actually had a third guy helping us with Submerged. But basically, we made this massive city, and everything was handcrafted. Every little climbing puzzle, every path was all hand-placed, and then we started getting feedback later in the project from people like, it'd be cool if there was, like, more interesting puzzles, and, you know, it'd be good if there was, like, different things you could do. And we're just like, no, we can't. It's just, it's all been done, and it's like, you know, it'd take us another year to remake it all. So we started thinking about, we need to be more flexible as a small team. We need to sort of make things that we can... react to the feedback we get and have an easy path for development to try and, you know, make our game better or make it more fun or take things out or add things. So that's what led us to this idea of making a procedural game. And it's been really great. Like the level of polish we've been able to add to just every little piece of the art and have it just sort of propagate magically through the entire game has been really really powerful, especially for just most of the level art was just made by, you know, one guy, John, here sitting beside me, and he's just been able to, like, sort of plug away at it slowly, and just the game, you know, as a whole just gets better. Whereas if you're working on these set pieces, then you spend 2 months making a building, and then just it's that building and nothing else.
Well, that building looks amazing, by the way. Like, this is an absolutely gorgeous game. I'm lucky enough that I've been playing it on an Xbox One X. The 4K HDR, by the way, thanks for doing HDR in a game. Everyone talks about, ooh, it's an Xbox One X enhanced title. No one does HDR, and things look fucking crazy in HDR. Holy hell.
Awesome. Do you have like a dark room to play it in or something? Is that what you do with it?
Yes.
Seeing it? Right. Nice.
Yeah, I had all the lights off earlier. The windows were closed. I was just enjoying it.
Yeah, I mean, you can thank Tim Sweeney for that. So, because that's all epic. You know, they do all that, and then we come along and lucky enough to be able to flick the switch and adjust. Had to adjust a few things, but that was actually pretty easy doing that stuff.
The whole HDR thing?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, I'm glad that you guys went with it because it looks fantastic.
Awesome.
Yeah, it really does. I play on a 1S, but I have the HDR enabled, and it does make a big difference.
We actually have the one 4K HD TV here with HDR, but it was like the cheapest one we could buy from Costco. And the HDR is terrible. So I'm glad it looks good for other people.
Did you guys fight over who gets to use the 4K TV?
Oh, it just sits here with like 1,000 dev kits plugged into it, so no one really gets to.
Then you're coming into work and doing rock, paper, scissors to see who gets to use it today.
Yeah, and someone else gets the, you know, the substandard 1080p TV on the other side.
For losers. So how big of a team do you guys have down there at Uppercut?
So we've got six on City of Brass. There's six full-time employees. Where there's five of us here in the office in Canberra, which is the capital of Australia. And we have another guy, Ben, who works remotely in Adelaide. So he just works over the internet and basically talk to him like we're talking to you on Skype. He's most of the time he's sort of floating around as a voice in the office. And then we have a few people we collaborate with. So all the audio was done, the sound effects and music was all done by Justin Mullins, who's another ex 2K Australia Irrational alumni. So he worked on Bioshock and Borderlands and those games. The guys that 2K Australia made. So he's worked with him he's a contracts audio to us. And the character art and a lot of the concept art was done by Andrew Lay, who we also worked with at 2K Australia.
Man, it's impressive that a game of this size and this good looking of a game was done by six people for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that comes down to that procedural, being able to make that procedural nature and just be able to like work on little pieces at a time and have it slowly improve. Yeah, I think that's been the big win that we've discovered. But also, you have to have a game design that suits procedural nature and a procedural production. So
very true.
It's a trade-off.
We have a question from our audience. Ace Platinum in the chat is asking, what is your favorite fast food and soda?
Oh, in Australia, my favorite fast food, it's not that fast. It's Pad Thai. Soda, I drink Sunkist, which is like, I don't know if they have that in the US. It's like a orange soda.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. But definitely Pad Thai. Thai food is awesome.
Nice. Cole, what is your favorite fast food and soda?
I don't really eat a whole lot of fast food. It's just
you're not American.
I know. Well, it's so far away. Like, I know I always talk about how far from everything I live, but it's literally just an hour just to get to any kind of restaurant.
So you're not ducking out to get nuggets.
Yeah, I mean, you just
she gets the possum nuggets from out front after the truck done drive by.
It's funny because this morning I was putting the girls on the bus and I could hear, I had let the chickens out and they had run across the field into the other side and I couldn't see them because the bus was running, but I could hear a turkey over by the chicken. It was a wild turkey. And I was like, ooh, you motherfucker, you don't realize how lucky you are that it's not season right now.
Well, I guess I should answer it myself. Favorite fast food, I'm going to go with Hardee's, Carl's Jr. for the West Coast people. And favorite soda, All time, I'm going to go with Mountain Dew Supernova, but they don't make it anymore. So it's in stores now, Baja Blast. I'm pumped that that's back.
I forgot to answer the soda part, but anybody that's ever listened to us at all knows I'm a huge fan of Dr. Pepper.
I was going to answer for Ed, who couldn't be with us. Yeah, he's a Dr. Pepper fan, too.
Dr. Pepper is life. I even have, like, pajama pants and T-shirts with Dr. Pepper logos on them. When I was in college, my first Christmas in college away from my family and my friends and my roommate, they got together and got me a case of Dr. Pepper as my Christmas present.
Oh, God.
So, yeah.
Just a case. That's nothing big. Just a case of soda. Case. They should have gotten you a pallet of soda, like 144 cases.
Well, we were a poor college kids, you know. I went to a college that everybody had to work on campus. And so it was how you paid off part of your scholarship, but they only ended up paying us, I think it was like $1.77 an hour was Jesus. Our actual take home. And we were only allowed to work 10 hours a week. So, I mean, you didn't make much. So for everybody to come together and buy, you know, a $7 case pop was a big deal.
$7 for a case? Where the fuck are you getting soda?
At Walmart. Yeah, here. Well, now here it is. Back then, I don't know, it was probably around $5.50 or $6, but still $7 here now for a 24 pack.
Oh, you're talking 24 packs. Okay.
Yeah.
I could see that being a bit
that's
more.
That's a half case of the 12 pack. So, that's not enough. That doesn't even wet your whistle.
I don't know. We're now going to turn this into a soda discussion forum.
Sorry.
No, it's just, to me, a case has always been a 12 pack.
How much is a case of pop in Australia?
Wait, hey, Evan. Hmm? How many cans? How many cans of Coke Zero are in the fridge? 36. We have 36.
36 is down there. What the?
Yeah.
Holy shit!
I need that in my life.
And it's got, even got a handle on top. You know,
a 36 pack. Are they 12 ounce? Or yeah, are they 12 ounce cans down there? I don't know if
200 mils. I think.
What can? Shit! Yeah. I don't have a can. Cole, do you have a can? I'm not getting up.
365.
Of course I do. 355 milliliter is a 12.
355. No, 375. We're 375.
So about the same.
More in your can.
And so we've got 36 of them.
They're bigger, and the cases are bigger. God, I'm moving to Australia. Fuck this.
Off.
Are you guys hiring if I move down there? Kind of want to get out of this country anyway.
The fridge is always stocked with Diet Coke. Or, sorry, Coke Zero, whatever it's called. Yeah. Real Coke. What's it called now? New Coke. Something. It's called
something. Oh, yeah, new stuff. They have, like, all kinds of different flavors. Remember how we said we weren't turning this into a pop discussion?
Yeah, we are. Do they have the new flavor Diet Cokes down in Australia?
I think there was a cherry one for a while.
Yeah, but still, you can still get cherry.
We can still get cherry. Maybe they haven't done Vegemite yet, but that's probably coming.
Vegemite soda.
You can ruin everything with putting Vegemite on it, except toast. I mean, that's brilliant.
Oh, it tastes brilliant,
but don't put it in. They tried to put it in chocolate, and nah, it's just horrible.
Good Lord, I've never had Vegemite, but I've heard the stories. What exactly is Vegemite?
As far as I understand, it's some sort of byproduct from the yeast when they make beer.
Yeah.
And it's like black sort of molasses type thing. And you just wave it over the bread. You don't actually put it on. You just have to like let the smell get in there. And it's delicious.
Is there like a hidden jar of Vegemite somewhere in the city of Brass?
Maybe. You have to find all the secrets.
Maybe that's what the explosive urns.
Yeah. Oh, God. It would just land and stay there. It wouldn't do anything. It would just stop.
You throw it at the wall and it just sticks to the wall.
Yeah.
That's not a glitch. That's the Vegemite.
Working as intended.
Well, I just have to write this down for the design doc. Yeah. Vegemite.
We did it again.
I tell everyone when we give awful ideas on the show, if you use one, all we want is a special thanks in the credits.
Yeah.
That's all. Just a thanks for your awful idea. I can't believe we put it in our game. What is wrong with us? Thanks.
We're to try to steer it back to the game, actually. Were there any special abilities with the whip that you guys wanted to include but weren't able to?
We played around with, Ryan was really interested in trying to get some, like, mechanics for when you were flying through the air, you're doing, you did a big, a sort of a whip in the air from a swing point. Mm-hmm. We wanted to try to do some sort of auto attack maneuvers where you could whip a guy while you were flying, and you'd zoom in and hit him with the sword, and we actually prototyped some of this, and there was some slow motion, put it into bullet time, and the whole thing just really sucked, so we cut it.
It sounded badass.
Awesome. It sounded awesome, and then, yeah, it was apparently pretty horrible. I think it got even cut before I gave it a go. It was so bad, it was in there for like 2 days. It was one of those ideas where I think everybody just went, oh, okay.
Yeah, also on the whip thing, I notice when you whip someone in a hand, they'll drop their weapon. When you whip them in the legs, they'll trip and fall down. You whip them in the head, you give them a really, really bad headache. Were you guys considering like a whip to the crotch and to see what happens there? Can skeletons get hurt in the crotch?
Well, you wouldn't think they should be, you know, getting headaches or blinded either, right? But
very true.
It was funny. The anecdote, I don't know how funny it is, but the anecdote for when we first put the whipping in, and we actually started, we were making a serious game, it was about whipping and hitting things with a sword, and we had this sort of idea of this Arabian Nights City of Brass story, and we put the tripping in, I think, first, and we all just started laughing, like, okay, so the tone of the game is going to be a bit lighter than we thought, because it was just funny. So we let ourselves sort of be a bit silly with those things, more than we have done in the past in our previous games, which is nice to be a bit lighter.
Are there any other parts of the body that you can attack that trigger some kind of special animation?
Not on the basic enemies, but some of the others have. You can use the whip pull to pull the shield out, so you can get in there behind the shield and hit the shielded enemies. And there's a couple of other guys you can whip things off their bodies, and then use them. So you can like pick up an object like you can from a distance, but you can pick it up off the. You can basically pick up a part of their body and then throw it back at them.
And then, of course, there's the whole whipping projectiles thing, which I was very, very, very slow to catch on with the gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been interesting deciding how much of that we should tell people and how much to let them learn. But I think people seem to have been learning it. I guess that one you have to stand there and go, what am I going to do? And try it, and then try it out.
Yeah, I died so many times trying to sword attack those orbs that came at me before thinking, hey, I have a whip. Maybe I should try this thing too.
Yeah, and in general in the game, if you're in doubt, like, just whip it and it'll probably do something.
Whip it good.
Yeah.
I had to YouTube how to take on the gatekeepers because I kept, like, I'd have full health and I'd just be running around going, I don't understand. I had tried to whip a couple of times, but I guess I missed because I couldn't quite get the hang on when the projectiles were coming. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I couldn't get a handle. Jeez. I couldn't
See,
get a handle.
We're all dying. We are all dying tonight.
So dead. I couldn't get a handle on when the projectiles were coming and like how close they were. I felt like a total idiot after I watched the YouTube videos because I was like, wow, I was either whipping too early or too late every fucking time.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of it comes down to timing, doesn't it? Especially with the whip, because there's it's not a single point of impact. There's a time, like there's a range of time, but it's only, you know, a couple of a quarter of a second or something that it's active that'll hit things.
Well, I found that I was messing my own self up too, because in one run I would have the whip that was longer, and then the next I wouldn't, and then I would be like, "Why can't I hit this?" And then I realized that was dumb.
Oh, yeah, I have a normal whip this time.
Yeah. YouTube can't save you when you do dumb shit like that.
So I know we're just about a day or so away from the release of the game at the time that we're recording this. What has the early preview buzz been like so far? Are you guys looking at a winner here critically, do you think?
The reviews will be coming out tomorrow, so I guess I'll answer that question tomorrow. From my experience, having a bunch of people play at PAX, people are really enjoying the game. Obviously, being a roguelike, there's going to be people who just don't like that type, that genre.
No.
It's a difficult game. But the people who came up and played say, it's a first-person roguelike. This is, it's awesome. I've been waiting for something like this. They were all really enjoying it. So, yeah, I'm feeling pretty confident that it's going to be well-received.
Was there any fan feedback from different events that you showed it off at that ended up making it into the game?
Definitely our early access users, those guys, the people who were playing it, they gave us a lot of feedback. I mean, the game actually changed quite a lot during early access. It was just about closing out 6 months, when in September last year. And a lot of the tuning and balance and a bunch of little mechanics too. There's a bunch of little sort of tuning to the mechanics and the way some of the equipment works. We got a lot of feedback from the community that we were able to just put in and sort of snowball from one update to the next. And they give us a bunch more feedback on what we'd done. It was quite a good experience for us doing early access.
You mentioned that earlier that the procedural generation was kind of affected by the feedback you got from Submerged. Was there any other feedback from Submerged that affected the development of City of Brass?
Yeah, Submerged was a very niche product, because it didn't have interactions or active gameplay. It was very, very much about just searching the environment, relaxing. And there was no danger, which was good. But I think maybe the audience for that type of game was already shrinking at the time when we put it out. So we wanted to make a game that was, I guess, a bit more sort of core game. I had probably a bigger potential audience. And that's why we started talking originally about that. Maybe we should go back to doing something, like Bioshock and the Bioshock games and Tribes is some of the things we've worked on in the past that are rational. And we're like, maybe we should go back to, doing some first-person action game. So I think that was, again, it was a reaction to, so I think all in all, Submerged actually ended up selling quite well over a long period, a two-year period. But we didn't knock it out of the park when it first shipped. So, there was definitely some, wanted to make a game that had a bit more meat to it that people could invest in. So also, the playtime with Submerged was most people only played it for about 2 or 3 hours. So we wanted something that was more replayability and more, more action and something people could learn and then come back and sort of get good at.
I will never get good.
Yeah, I'd say Submerged was, I absolutely loved it. It was actually one of the first games I won a code for from the SML podcast.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
You're friggin' welcome, by the way. Did you ever think years later you would be giving games away yourself on the SML podcast?
Not at all. I didn't see that coming anywhere. but it's when I started playing City of Brass and I started doing the research for this interview, one of the things that stood out when it says, like, I was looking up Uppercut games and it said Submerged, and I was like, wait a second. Because the two games are so dramatically different. Like, as you mentioned, Submerged has no combat. It's just, relaxed. And whereas this is, it doesn't have to be fast paced, but it is a combat heavy first person. So it was a dramatic shift. And I just really wanted to know the mindset that went into that. Go ahead.
I guess to speak to that a bit more, we'd made, when we first started up, we made a bunch of mobile games, the Epoch games, and they were really, it was a third-person cover shooter, the Epoch series, and that was sort of crazy, frantic combat as well. So for us, we felt like we were just going back to what we'd done before we did this sort of outlier experiment with Submerged, but I guess from if anyone who'd only ever seen that as our first game, because all the other things we'd done before was mobile. Yeah, it's a real like U-turn, right?
Yeah, it really was. And not in a bad way either. And that's the thing that I think is most impressive, is that Submerged was a wonderful experience, in my opinion. And nobody cares about my opinion, but that is what it is.
No, not at all.
Okay, I'll take that.
I just really loved the experience. And then City of Brass, even though it's so incredibly different, again, it's just another really good experience, and it does what you set out to do really well. So even though they're so dramatically different, you really cover both bases perfectly.
Oh, thanks. Wow. So, well, that's one of the awesome things about being a small independent studio is we can sort of flip-flop around and try different genres and do a experience game like Submerged that it's all about sort of just being in the moment and relaxing, and then go back to doing combat. And, we can sort of basically try out new things. That's what keeps it interesting, too.
I think one of my favorite things related to Submerged is back when Ed came on the show, when Submerged was still fairly recent. He described the game as a walk-sploration game, and I have used that term religiously since then instead of walking sim.
Yeah, walk-sploration. Yeah. Yep. Well, there was another one that someone came up with, like X, something to do with the boat, now I can't remember. So.
But yeah, I have used walk-sploration so much since then. It's such a perfect term.
Yeah, and I feel like the games without combat get a bad rap because there's obviously an audience for them, and it's just a different it's a different experience. A lot of people seem to play Submerged with their children. They want something they can do together that doesn't require a lot of reaction time, and doesn't matter if you can't die, you can't fall off a ledge, and doesn't matter if you run the boat straight up into a building, doesn't explode, you can just turn around and keep going. So. Yeah, I think it's really.
I like games like that. I could beat games like that.
Yeah, I used to boat around the city for hours. I don't know whether Ed told you in that podcast, but that game originally had a whole combat element. You could go inside the buildings and fight things. And we showed it to one of our friends really early in development, and we kept saying this. Go into the building. There's the combat. And he was like, whatever, this is just really cool. I'm just going to explore. And so we changed it and just took all the other stuff out.
I'm trying to think. I believe Ed did talk about that when he was on. I'm trying to look up when that was. Episode 170. So that was March of 2016. So it's been over 2 years. Wow. Well, AJ, I know we've been chatting for quite a while. Is there anything about the game that you wanted to talk about that we didn't bring up?
No, I'm just happy to, talk about it with you and find out the things you want to know about. But I guess let everyone know it's coming out in the next... I can never remember where. It's like Australia, we get it early. We're a day ahead. So for me...
You're in the future.
It's coming out like in about 12 hours or something. But for the rest, it's tomorrow or the next day or the next day.
By the time the show's out, the game is out already. So if you're listening to this on the full episode form and you're not hanging out in our chat room right now, the game's out now. So you should probably,
excellent.
Find it and grab it, stuff like that. So, Cole, did you have any other questions?
I do not. I checked off all of my notes. Like a good co-host.
Look at you with your notes and keeping track of things.
I did good this time.
The only note that I literally have written down is your name. That's it. Just so I could remember it.
Joe makes a note on a post-it card that says, do not forget guest name. And then forgets to write the name.
You've been calling me Andrew. My name's John. No, I'm
just... Oh, son of a bitch. Son of a... Your Skype thing is lying to me. Well, Andrew, it has been fantastic having you on the show chatting about City of Brass. do you want to give us all the plugs on where people can stay up to date with you and what you're doing and Uppercut Games and the game and everything else?
Okay, so we're on Twitter at Uppercut Games and Facebook at Uppercut Games, all these places, pretty much Uppercut Games. Type that in, you'll find us, and cityofbrassgame.com if you want to check it out. That's the place to go.
Cool. And the game is out right now by the time people are listening to this show. How much is it and where can people get it?
It's 1990 something, 99, 95, whatever that price point is, US dollars. And you can get it on Xbox One, PlayStation 4, and on Steam.
And it is gorgeous on the X. I can say that. It is absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
But again, it has been fantastic having you on the show. Everybody else, stick around. We're going to take a quick break. Be back with some more show. Andrew, do you have any final words to end the interview?
No, just nice to meet you, Cole, and thanks a lot, Joe.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining, as usual, Cole Martin. Cole, how are you doing?
I'm alive!
You said that last time.
It's still true!
Also,
you're alive or you're undead.
Just about to say, yeah. Also joining us for a bit this episode, Steve O'Bortz, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm enjoying
this wonderful... holy shit. I just realized this is the second half of the show. I don't have to do the what's up, everyone. Welcome back, everyone. Fuck, I'm keeping all this. I don't give a shit.
I was hiding in the bathroom for the first half of the episode.
We had an interview for the first half of the episode that we recorded yesterday, and I forgot. That's how on the ball I am tonight. Steve-O, how are you doing?
Doing good. I actually, you can see I'm holding up a book. One of Friday Night Fanfiction's fans bought it from me, and we've been reading it sort of as a fan group. It's one book in a series of eight called The Angel Wore Fangs, about Viking vampire angels who fight ISIS. And it's a romance novel. It's one of those airport romance novels. I know, and this is for sale. This has an ISBN number and a recommended USA price of $8. But in all seriousness, I'm doing very, very good.
You have the weirdest stories, Steve.
I have a weird and wonderful life. My life is modeled off of that Nickelodeon show, Wild and Crazy Kids.
So you do physical challenges with...
I was on What Would You Do when I was a kid.
Were you?
Yeah, I got slimed. It was great.
Is there video? Tell me there's video.
There should be. I will have to find it. I hope there is video. I was very young, and I can't remember if it was recorded, but I was at Nickelodeon Studios for a taping of the episode. I don't know if it ever aired.
Oh my god, I want to see this if it happened.
They gave me a certificate and everything.
Oh my god, that is cool as hell. I didn't know that about you.
I got a lot of stories.
I'm learning things about you. You are officially the second person I know that has been on this show as a guest or a host that was on a Nickelodeon show as a contestant.
Who's the other one?
Chris Huber. He was on Legends of the Hidden Temple.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Hopefully they didn't fail miserably at the Shrine of the Silver Monkey.
I don't remember how far he said he got.
Mm.
I don't remember.
But that's awesome.
That means
So we've had you on What Would You Do? Chris was on Legends of the Hidden Temple, and I've had Phil Moore on the show, who has been, you know, the host of Nick Arcade.
Yeah. So. And that was, I love that show.
So who's next? Who's going to be next?
Well, they need to bring those shows back. I know Mark Summers said he was willing to come back and do more hosting for the show. So why not now? Nickelodeon, bring them back.
Didn't they announce that Double Dare's coming back this summer?
I don't know. I'll have to Google that while you talk about what we're actually supposed to be talking about.
We're supposed to talk about video games. Isn't that cool?
What are those?
Yeah, we should probably dive into the news of the week. I don't have too much news to talk about this week, but let's get the big thing out of the way. It has come out that God of War has sold 3.1 million copies in 3 days.
Wow, go Dad of War.
Yeah, making it the fastest selling PS4 exclusive, like pretty handily. The runner up, Uncharted 4, sold 2.7 million copies in a full week. Horizon Zero Dawn hit 2.6 million copies in 2 weeks. God of War over 3 million in less than half a week. That is insane.
That's kind of amazing. Yeah. But I mean, did we expect it to do badly, or is it just a matter of we didn't expect it to do this well?
I think we expected it to do really, really fucking well, but not this fucking well.
Ah.
Then again, you consider there's like 75 million PS4s out there.
And I still don't own one.
It's okay.
I know how you feel about Sony.
Yeah. Yeah, but what are you going to do, right?
There's your drinking game. Every time Steve-O comes on an episode of SML, drink every time he mentions the Sony hate.
We're not trying to kill the few people that actually listen.
That would take a couple of lives fairly easily. Yeah. let's see, what other news is there this week? 2 new games were added to the Xbox One backward compatibility lineup this week. On Tuesday, we got Saints Row 2. Awesome, very, very awesome. And then Thursday, Dragon Age 2. So it is a week of sequels.
Oh.
Yeah, good stuff. A lot of conversation going on. You guys are just nailing it with
I don't know what you want from me. I didn't own those originals.
Talk to me, you bastard.
Okay, but I can bring up I could be the Mr. Magfest here and bring up obscure shit that has nothing to do with what you're talking about.
Sure, why not?
I can mention that the first ever functional Vita emulator started booting homebrew and commercial ROMs without video, but still, you know, getting initial code put in this past week. So Vita emulation should be a thing in the near future. Probably within the next year or two, it should be functional.
That's pretty awesome.
Like for somebody, and yes, it's Sony, but for basically the spiritual precursor of the Nintendo Switch, which is doing fan-frickin-tastic, it's really nice to see interest in keeping that system alive, because apparently Sony has had for many years zero interest in keeping it alive itself in the United States.
Pretty much.
You know, and, you know, when are we going to get Sega Saturn backwards compatibility? When is Sega going to come up with another system?
That would be amazing. Have they even found a way to emulate Saturn yet?
Oh, yeah. For a while, the most popular emulator called SSF was maintained solely by a single Japanese developer. There's a couple new ones coming out. There's Nova that's being made. There's a core in RetroArch, which does Saturn emulation incredibly well, based on Mednafen. And there's Yabayuse. There's a whole bunch. You can play most Saturn games using RetroArch without issue. You just won't be able to play them necessarily perfectly.
Yeah.
But I love the Saturn, and anything related to it makes me happy. Which, again, if Xbox One had backwards compatibility for Saturn games, boom, instant purchase for me. If you're listening, Microsoft, that's how you're going to get me.
I'm at the point where I wouldn't be shocked if they introduced Dreamcast.
I hope they do. There were a few games on there that ended up going to other systems, like Skies of Arcadia, Sonic Adventure 2 DX, but there's so many other games for the system that never left.
Yeah.
and it
like Sonic Shuffle.
Oh, why did you have to there? Seaman, get
I'm more
C-Man.
Sad. I'm sad that you brought up Skies of Arcadia because the world needs more Skies of Arcadia, and Sega just ignores it. See, the dogs agree.
The dog wants more Skies of Arcadia.
We mentioned Skies of Arcadia. Those dogs go crazy. Dogs love the Skies of Arcadia.
Yes, but all the awesome of Skies of Arcadia is completely negated. Sorry, what was that, Cole?
I was trying to find the mute button to tell them to hush, but I can't find the mute button on my new phone.
Is it on the screen if you look at it? Does it have a mute icon?
I think it might have been muted, and I don't know. Like, if I push it, it's black, and then it's white, and I don't know which is which.
Well, push it. Well, start talking, and then push it.
Now.
I have to touch the screen.
Yep, there you're muted.
Come listen to Steve-O wax poetic about dead systems and Cole figure out how to operate her new phone on the Yay! SML podcast.
These are the best kind of shows where
she did a thing.
The things.
I always feel like wherever I go, I ruin things. At least here, somebody might potentially appreciate it. Which is fine. But no, that's cool. Talking about Microsoft, it's nice to see them care about backwards compatibility. I know that for a while wasn't a big thing. It's still nice to see slow and steady progress.
It's nice to see someone care about backward compatibility, because no one else does.
Dreamcast, get a Skies of Arcadia.
Yeah, seriously. Actually, speaking of, there is a system that can apparently play Skies of Arcadia now.
Which is?
The Switch.
Oh, they're porting it over.
No, they apparently, someone has gotten the Dolphin emulator running on the Switch.
So let me talk about this.
Let's hear it.
What happened was they discovered, because the Switch runs on NVIDIA's Tegra system, which is a system on a chip, and the Tegra hardware has a built-in hardware security flaw that even if you patch firmware over it, will never be completely removed. They can only obfuscate it by additional layers. So for firmware version, I believe 3.2 and below, it's 3.2 or 3.0 or below, you can, as long as you haven't updated, go through that exploit and run unsigned code on your machine. So what they did was they ran unsigned code and booted to a Linux system. So what you're seeing is Dolphin running on Linux, running on the Switch. Right. So
didn't they say that exploit could not be patched over at all? Like, all the systems that are out now are vulnerable, and there's no way to block it out. I thought that's what they said.
Anything that's based on the Tegra is going to have that vulnerability, but unfortunately, there are ways to make it more difficult to access that specific patch. So it's really nice to see the hardware exploit community working their butts off on this. And seeing Dolphin run on a Nintendo Switch, it was a beautiful moment. And it makes me very happy to be part of that enthusiast community where we can make miracles happen.
That's pretty neat.
Mistakes into miracles.
I don't know, man. I think it could be open a door to a world of possibilities if they could figure out how to get homebrew working on there without any way for Nintendo to cover it up. That's the big thing. If Nintendo can't block it.
So, well, they can't block it. They can just make it harder to do. That in order to block it, they would have to issue a new version of the Switch hardware itself. Yeah. So, before we move on, let me just tell you, the emulator multi-system RetroArch runs on the following platforms: Linux, Windows 10, 8, 7, and Vista, Windows XP, Windows 98, Windows ME, Windows 2000, Windows 95, Windows 98, Apple Mac OS X and old Apple Mac OS, Android, Firefox, you can run it in your browser, iOS, BlackBerry, PlayStation 3, PlayStation Portable, PlayStation Vita, Xbox, Xbox 360, GameCube, Wii U, Nintendo 3DS, Raspberry Pi, and the GCW Zero.
I don't know what that last one is.
Neither do I. But The fact that you can run this emulator on other systems, it's going to be fucking running on the Switch before you know it.
True.
I run it on my Vita, and it runs very well. I can play Super Nintendo games on my Vita, and it's fucking wonderful.
I need you to come visit so that you could get my Vita to do that shit.
Okay. I'll see what I can do.
Because we all know Sony's not going to actually update their system because they gave up on the fucking thing.
No, absolutely. I agree. So what other news we got?
Eight new games have been added to Origin Access on the PC. So if you're an Origin Access member, you can now play Mad Max, Pillars of Eternity Hero Edition, Prison Architect, Torment, Tides of Numenera, Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, Virginia, Ember, and Spore.
Ooh. Oh, Spore. Oh, boy. All the dick monsters you could possibly want.
And then the last bit of news that I have is, what do you guys think of the whole FTC saying that warranty void if removed stickers are officially illegal?
I want to have them look at my broken PlayStation 2 and fix it.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
No, the warranty on that ran out many years ago, even if I hadn't broken the sticker. But that's great to hear.
Wait, are you telling me that you have a broken PS2? What?
I've got three broken PS2s, but five working ones. I got two from, like, when my wife married me, and there was
just
one
wedding gifts, I guess?
Just stuff that she had lying around. We're still clearing out her room from her parents' place.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but it's great. It's another step in the direction of, as long as you own the hardware, what you do to it is your business. And if you break it on your own terms, if you don't break it on your own terms, that should not be held against you if something happens.
Yeah.
So that's really nice to hear. I do have a small piece of news. I don't know if you covered it.
Well, Cole, what do you think of the whole warranty thing?
I'm glad to hear it. I hate those fucking stickers because I'm the queen of popping shit open. For the longest time, I just wanted to, like, paint my Xbox, and I was afraid to take the case off of it to paint it for fear of voiding the warranty. And now I can, and they can fuck off and still have to fix it if I break it.
So what did you paint it?
I didn't, because I was afraid of breaking the warranty seal.
Well, what would you
have? I've had to... What would I have? I don't know. No, I mean, it probably would have been Care Bears or some shit, but
yeah.
It would have been adorable, whatever it was.
Care Bear stare.
Yeah. Donovan agrees.
Steve-O, what was your news?
Yeah, sorry.
Extra tickets. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I didn't mean to snipe you on the last bit of news, Cole.
You meant
so.
It.
Okay. It's okay. Nobody cares what I got to say anyway.
The retribution. So you remember the first time you had me on the show, Joe, the game that you had me review?
One of the Senran Kagura games.
So two things. One's personal, the other is actual news. First of all, I finally got my first anime body pillow, and of course it's a Senran Kagura one.
Why am I not shocked that you officially have an anime body pillow?
The look on my wife's face when I showed it to her inside the with the actual pillow inside of it, she's just like,
how loud was her sigh?
That wasn't. She was giggling. She was giggling like. The thing is that now we spoon for two when going to sleep. But actually, talking about Senran Kagura, did you know that they announced bringing over not one but two Senran Kagura games in 2018?
No, I did not know that.
XSEED announced it about a week ago. They're localizing Senran Kagura Burst Renewal, which is a reimagining of the first Senran Kagura game for the 3DS on PlayStation 4 and Windows PC. And it's going to have high-def anime cutscenes, as far as I'm aware, based on the original anime. And completely redone gameplay. I'm looking forward to it because as much as I love the series, the original Senran Kagura Burst on 3DS is ridiculously rough around the edges. And they will also be localizing Senran Kagura, I think it's Reflex or Refresh. I think it's Reflex for the Nintendo Switch.
Interesting.
The Notorious demo where you could do a little massage on your Switch touchscreen.
Oh, Lord.
Yes. Yes, I agree. But it's great to see XSEED continue getting quality work. They're a great localization company. And, of course, is a staunch supporter of the Senran Kagura series. I'm excited.
I would not expect anything less of you, Steve-O, than being ungodly excited for those.
I'll be doing a day one review with video of me and the Senran Kagura body pillow.
Do you have the body pillow with you?
Do you want me to go get it?
Kinda, yeah, I do.
All right, yes, I'll go get it.
Nice. So any news from you, Cole? Anything?
I would like to tell you about news, but there's four-wheelers going up and down the road and people yelling. No wonder my dogs are losing their shit. Actually, was curious what your guys' opinion of the New York Times article was, if you read that.
Hey, that was very vague. What are your opinions on this article?
No. There was an they wrote an article about esports arenas, and basically it was just like gamers want to eat junk food and watch people play Fortnite. And that was like the whole headline of the article. And the whole thing is just how like, oh, this is an esports arena and these people are out of their mom's basements and they're in real spaces now. And this event was sponsored by Cup of Noodles. And I'm taking it you didn't read it.
No, I did not read that article at all. But Steve-O, that body pillow looks fantastic.
Oh, Lord.
I'm kind of hoping that we don't get blocked on Twitch for having...
You won't. It's still PG.
It's like a hard PG-13. A hard PG-13.
The other side is not PG. I made sure to show you the side that was.
Steve-O, did you read the article she was talking about?
What article?
Wow.
He was
upstairs.
Getting a fucking body pillow.
I went upstairs to go get waifu.
Wow.
What was the article?
Okay. There was an article in the New York Times about esports arenas. And basically the headline was like, gamers just want to eat Hot Pockets, junk food, and watch people play Fortnite. And the whole article is just dripping in these gamer stereotypes of like how the esports arena event was sponsored by Cup of Noodles and that, you know, gamers are coming out of their mom's basements and they're invading real spaces and taking over movie theaters and things like that.
I take offense to that stereotype and I'm not very appreciative of the article that was written.
I resemble that stereotype in many ways. I think it's a horrible double standards because first these people are ostracized because they don't leave their basements. You know, in the 70s and 80s and at very least the early 90s, the nerd and gamer culture was frowned upon because it was considered a completely secluded lifestyle that you had to go to like these extremely niche like game stores to do Warhammer or Magic the Gathering, or you had to go to your friend's basement in order to play Dungeons and Dragons or, you know, play Super Mario World or Bomberman or whatever. And now that these people are finally coming out of the woodwork, not only getting sponsorships from major companies that are drawing in lots of money and lots of attention, that they're being ostracized because they're bringing it out in public. I don't get the negative backlash. This is a wonderful opportunity, not just for the gaming culture, but for societal integration and business. But like, how much money do you think people have made? Look at Dota 2's International. Huge amounts of money. It's really frustrating to have people still stuck in those kinds of mentalities when it comes to gamer culture.
Yeah.
And I could go on a very long and eloquent rant, but I will need to be supplicated with CeCe's pizza afterwards.
Hey, I'm still waiting on you for that. So
no, but
we had a March date, goddammit.
I know, and I dropped the ball, and my balls did unfortunately not drop. But yeah, it grinds my gears very much so whenever I see publications consider gaming culture in such a negative light?
I don't know. I think it's something that everyone's going to have to deal with pretty much forever. Stereotypes are just always going to be there, and all we can do is just say, fuck them.
Have we as a culture moved past the whole jock stereotype? Because we have people who play football in college and hockey and whatnot, and they're also outstanding academics. They're great students, mm-hmm. and they're social. So if we're able to get past the whole jock stereotype, then eventually, once esports makes its way into the collegiate arena, we'll have to get past that too.
Wait for it to hit the Olympics, and then we're good.
Oh man, play Tony Hawk Pro Skater 3 at the Olympics. Do it.
I don't think they're going to go that old school.
I know.
Anyway, that's all for the news that I have. I guess that's everything news-wise, huh?
Yes.
Cool. Do you want to give away a game?
Yes. Sure.
Cool, because we have some copies of the game Deep Ones to give away on Xbox One. We asked you to email us and tell us why you want the game. We got three emails, so let's go through these. The first one from Joe.
Let me ask, is Deep Ones a game about making your own Pizza Hut personal pan deep dish pizza?
Sadly, no. It is an undersea adventure platformer kind of thing.
Well, that sounds just as good.
Yeah, but no pizza.
Ugh.
Anyway, first email, John Prudlow says, Dear SML Podcast, I don't know much about this game other than Chris Taylor's review from a few weeks back. However, it seems like a cool, challenging 8-bit platformer based on that review and the screenshots I've seen. I never owned a ZX Spectrum computer, but we did have an Apple IIe back in the day with its beautiful green monochromatic display. Remember playing games like Conan and Montezuma's Revenge on that machine and thoroughly enjoyed the side-scrolling platformers, along with tower defense games like Rescue Raiders. Deep Ones is a step up from those games and looks visually cool with its unique throwback style. On top of that, you get to play a scuba diver named Diver, who is riding around on a seahorse during parts of the game. Sign me up for some deep sea exploration. Thank you for your consideration.
Oh, he's so polite.
Next email is from Aroto Tomato, who says, Deep Ones is also the name of my bunghole. Hey there, SML Awesome Cast. Yo, this game looks tight, kind of like ASCII visual speaking, or ASCII. How do you say it, Steve-O?
ASCII.
ASCII, is it?
Yes.
Ass. Anyway, I'm down, count me in. Going right is what I do best. Unfortunately, I've been meaning to go left for a while, and no, I'm not talking about politics. Lord knows I have no idea what's happening with that. I just hope whoever is in power is doing a good job. I don't hear anything on Twitter, so I assume everything is going great. Anyhow, this game is reminding me of a video game idea I had when I was a teenager. It was called Astronauts of the Deep, and it told the story of Captain Morris on a quest to find the cure for his daughter. So he and his 5-person crew go to the bottom of the ocean, a place only James Cameron, the filmmaker, has visited, to find the life form that can be used as a cure. Here's the kicker. At the start of the game, you learn that Captain Morris is also infected, same as his daughter. But in the early stages, so it doesn't show. After a year, your flesh starts to fall and you cough blood and shit. And he knows, and you gotta infect your own crew without them knowing it, because you're gonna need test subjects to test the cure. So it's like a stealth game, a scientific research game, and an exploration game with minor combat. And it's a roguelike, as in you gotta keep restarting and making things easier, knowing ahead the obstacles until you finally succeed and stuff. And as the days go on, your crew starts to get suspicious of you, so you must stop them from finding out the truth. And you gotta be careful because you can run out of test subjects without figuring out the cure and having to restart and trying different methods and tactics. Anyhow, here's my Kickstarter page. I only need $50 million.
Wow.
Holy shit.
Aroto never lets us down, man. Never.
Pretty much never. Final emails from John Harvey, who says, I'd like a copy of Burp Games Deep Ones for Xbox, please. I'm guessing you'll probably want to know why, so here goes. A major reason is probably pure nostalgia. A lot of devs are doing the whole retro pixel art thing, but so many of them focus on 8 or 16-bit era. It's nice to see them try to emulate the old ZX Spectrum back when 48K could build a whole world. Everyone at my school either had a Spectrum or a Commodore 64. We'd swap games on audio tape, sometimes even paper copies of the program. They'd be ripped from a magazine if you were lucky, hastily scribbled on a school notebook if you weren't. You'd load up the game, watch the flashing lines of color, you'd listen to the screech of machine code, and wait patiently for the latest and a long list of brilliant new worlds to explore. Many an hour was lost to Chucky Egg, R-Type, Back to School, Football Manager, and many, many more. A lot of gamers my age got their introduction to home games thanks to the Spectrum. Because of that, we'll always have a special place in my gaming memories, and I'd love to recapture those moments with a little playthrough of Deep Ones. Thanks for the chance, and good luck, everyone. P.S. It's also based on the Deep Ones, part of Cthulhu Mythos, which obviously wins the extra coolness points. Good stuff. So three good entries, and best news of all, we have three codes. So everybody's getting a copy.
Yay!
Yay!
It's so hard to choose when that happens.
I know.
I always feel so bad for the ones left out.
It makes it so much easier when we have just enough codes for...
It does. It does. And while you guys were doing that, I went and looked it up. Apparently, there is a Wii game called Pizza Delivery Boy, not sponsored by Pizza Hut, but at least there is a pizza video game, so now I have to go get it.
Sweet.
It's made by Bajesco, and of course, I looked up pizza video games, and one of the first articles that shows up is, Millennials are choosing pizza, push-ups, and video games over church.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
And?
You don't even need
I'm failing to see the problem with this setup.
Yeah, seriously. Works for me. I don't know. Yeah, works for Donovan, too, clearly.
Donovan's cool with it.
You gotta run outside and start throwing shit at those people on the four-wheelers.
I don't even know what's going on. Like, I muted at one point because I heard a four-wheeler coming, and I finally found the mute button on my phone. And then all of a sudden I hear, holy shit, motherfucker, and then, like, two people are yelling, and I'm sitting there going, this is like half the population of this town, and I don't even know what's going on out here. And then
where
it stopped.
Where do you live?
I live in a tiny little redneck town of 42 people. And I live on the outskirts at that. Like, we are 5 miles from the actual town.
So, how many horror movies have been filmed where you are?
All of them.
All of them. Well, that's a good answer.
Holy God.
It's a good one.
Anyway, should we jump to the reviews, get these over and done with?
Sure.
Yes. Steve-O, I know you don't have too much time, so we're going to start off with the one for Steve-O. First game to talk about tonight is called East 8 Lacrimosa of Dana, developed by Nihon Falcom, published by NIS America, released April 16th on Steam for $59.99. East returns with a brand new adventure for the first time in 8 years. Adol awakens shipwrecked and stranded on a cursed island. There, he and the other shipwrecked passengers he rescues from form a village to challenge fearsome beasts and mysterious runes on the isolated island. Dark Mika covered this one, and Steve-O, you're going to read what she says, so let's hear it.
Well, this is the first I've heard of Wise 8 Lactose Intolerant Nana, so I'm excited to read about it.
Ease.
So Lactose Intolerant Nana is fine, I just have to say ease. There's a game pitch for you, Nipponichi Software. Ease 8 is a mild RPG action-adventure game. You play as an adventurer named Adol. You're on a boat. Yeah, a boat, motherfucker, on a boat.
Take a good, hard look at the motherfucking boat.
I'm tempted to just say coughs instead of coughing. Anyways, look, I do a show reading this shit, so I have to make fun of it. It's what I do. Indeed. Anyways, as expected, since I mentioned the boat, it obviously goes bye-bye. Like NSYNC, you get attacked by tentacles, not like NSYNC, and they bring the ship down. Now, I guess I should mention this is not one of those types of games, and Adol is a guy. I don't care that it's a Japanese games. You realize you wrote it like that?
Oh, you're going to run into a bunch of those. So have fun.
These tentacles are not those type of tentacles. Oh, dang, and I got the Senran Kagura body pillow out for nothing. Supposedly, anyways, you awaken now a castaway on a remote and cursed island. It's up to you to not get killed by the beasts that roam the island. Find other castaways and find a way off the island without becoming a toy for the tentacles. Have you seen Swiss Army Man?
No.
Okay. Are you familiar with the premise of Swiss Army Man?
No.
So Daniel Radcliffe, I believe he won an award for playing a corpse the entire movie.
Oh,
and
I think I do know this one.
This is the one about the guy who's stuck on an island and this corpse is magic and he basically rides it like a boat because it keeps farting.
Yeah.
Over to. Yep. It's really fucking weird. And I can't do it justice, but this is probably something that could be resolved by Daniel Radcliffe in the game.
Maybe everything could be solved by Daniel Radcliffe in a game.
The game eventually gives you 6 charitors, total 3 of which are used in the party at any given time, and they switch out super easily, even in the middle of combat, which is all real time, which I love. Combat is fairly fun as there's different types of damage and enemies are weak to specific types, so hit its weak point for massive damage. So it's always good to keep one of each of the 3 types in your party at a time, or if you're fighting against a group of same type, to put 2 of that type in your party so you can fuck everything up more quickly. I hope you're taking notes. There will be an exam on this after the lesson. Special attacks are, well, not that special. You unlock a ton of them for each character, and your special attack gauge raises pretty fast, so you can use them numerous times each fight. You can have up to 4 specials equipped for each character, and those attacks are leveled up as you use them, which takes a while, but it buffs the strength of the attacks up to max level 4, I think it is. You start at 1 and rank up 3 times, I believe, maybe just 2 times. I'm not sure anymore. It's been a while since I've had one not maxed at this point, and I'm kind of hungry.
You added that.
I will editorialize this as much as I need to. Audio is great. Visuals are okay. I mean, this isn't a standard console game. It's a port of a Vita game, so it looks a bit dated. It reminds me of the Neptunia games or the Tales of games, even. That's the visual style. Very basic and straightforward. I that kind of style myself.
See, I thought the game on PS, because I checked it out on PS4 a while back. I thought it looked fucking incredible. I would imagine the Steam version would look good as well. I don't know.
So, Vita upscaled ports are hit or miss. It depends on if they redo any of the original animations or static images, and also what the engine is running. But it mostly results in this. It looks better than a PlayStation 3, but not as good as a PS4 game because they didn't really design it to go this high res. I've seen these played on the Vita, and it runs well on the system, and they had to degrade some of the visuals to make it run well there. And if they're taking those assets and pulling it up, unless they spend an inordinate amount of time making it look good, it's just going to look okay.
True.
So there's my actual editorializing. There you go. Now, I mentioned that it's a port currently. This port is okay, and that wouldn't have been the case even a week ago. It's still finicky, and if you get photosensitive seizures, don't get the game, as there are strobe lighting effects that show up that aren't supposed to exist.
Oh boy.
That's not good. I know from personal experience, was not fun. Most of those issues were patched just recently, but some of them still persist, so that is a medical warning currently still. There are some other annoying bugs in the game, but they're fairly minor, until the most recent patch strobing was really bad and so was crashing. I put over 40 hours into the game, and about a quarter of that was redoing stuff from crashes, and about 7 to 8 of that was getting through an area slowly because it was strobing like crazy. Now that it's fixed, I've moved through that area in less than an hour. So it's still a bit buggy, but NIS is working on it, and sadly/annoyingly, this seems to be fairly common with NIS games. Can vouch, that's unfortunate. However, they always fix the issues, and in the end, the games are always fairly well-loved. I didn't get through as much of the game as I'd have liked before doing this review, and that is because of the crashing and strobe lighting issues, which have both recently been fixed. But for 4 to 5 days, I sat with my thumb up my ass, waiting, hoping a patch would come through, and it did, like just this week, and I've been on the game nonstop since then.
I just want to point out that I am incredibly mad that she said I'd of instead of I'd have.
I would also like to hope that the person who reviewed this did wash their hands after sticking their thumb up their butt. Going back to the game. Now, for $60 right now, hell no. Honestly, I think the game should be to like $30, $40 range. The scrammer. It's like I'm right there yesterday when I was doing this with other material. But it's a Vita port, and I think handheld games and their ports should be cheaper than console games, but that's not how life is. But regardless, with the finicky game behavior, I would say not to buy it right now. Wait 2 to 3 months, but then hopefully all the bugs will be gone completely, and it'll be worth calling it a full, proper game. I think wait till it's on 25% sale or something, and then the price would be more aligned to what I think is appropriate. Sorry. But the game is worth owning. It is a fairly fun game. It has a decent story that's mostly fun-loving, but has some tear-jerking moments in it, and it's shaping up to be a 60 to 80 her game.
80 her.
Her game.
It's a shame that NIS games, or at least this one, just has run into so many issues with the PC port of it. The game got delayed for a while, came out, still had some issues, but at least they're still working on it.
Still runs better than Arkham.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Also, who wrote this review?
Dark Mika.
Okay. Dark Mika, 82 out of 100. I liked some of your phrasing. Your grammar and punctuation needs a lot of work. Might recommend an outside tutor.
I'm telling you, the biggest thing that got me there is I'd of.
You it, really don't like that.
It drives me crazy when people say things like should of, would of. That's not a fucking thing. It should have, or an apostrophe V-E. Do you people not know?
And how have you come on Friday Night Fan Fiction 2 times already and survived?
You've only had me on once.
Well, we can change that.
I've been wanting you to change
that. I sent you the link. All you got to do is sign up.
You didn't send me a link.
I did send you the link.
You told me about a link, but you didn't send me a link.
I gave you the website. Just
you told me
at
MAGFest.
No, I sent you the... We can talk about this during couples counseling, Joe.
You son of a bitch. I will kill you. Oh, Steve, are you going to stick around and listen to more reviews, or are you going to bounce?
I'll stick around till 10:30 and then I'll skedaddle.
Cool. Well, then we will jump on to the next game, and that is called Outbreak: The Nightmare Chronicles, developed and published by Dead Drop Studios. Release May 1st on Xbox One for $4.99. As the city burns and countryside is engulfed by the epidemic, you're now alone and forced to live with this new reality. Monstrous beasts and disfigured remnants roam freely with their numbers increasing rapidly. Scattered and separated from your fellow survivors, you fled to a large manor estate to escape the relentless horde. Your only goal now is survival, but somehow you know your fate is already sealed. Cole, tell us about this one.
Hi, I've played these games before. Outbreak: The Nightmare Chronicles is the third in the Outbreak series from Dead Drop. It is pretty much exactly like the last one.
I was mentally confusing this. I confused Outbreak with Outlast. All right.
No, this is not Outlast.
I reviewed okay, those yeah. Two. Every time okay. There's a horror game, it comes to me because everybody also prefers these. So,
you and I can have some wonderful conversations because I love horror games.
I play all the scary things. So, this is if you've played the new Nightmare, this is identical, pretty much. It is a continuation of the story. It is supposed to be more of like a sequel. We see the return of Lydia, who was one of our heroes in the new Nightmare. So this picks up where her story left off, and she's been separated from the group. She finds herself at this giant mansion, and now it's up to you to guide her through it and survive. You have to solve various puzzles. These aren't ever really anything that's going to, like, rock your world, though.
Sorry. I heard it.
I heard it coming, and I was like, I don't have time to pause.
And it came through the mic just enough that I can't just, like, truncate that silence, and I'm too lazy to write down where this is.
You need to edit. So, so you have some puzzles.
You just randomly interrupt the rest of the review with.
So there are puzzles. God I've seen this show before.
Oh, so we're doing GTA 5 now.
Anyway, Outbreak.
Okay, so there are puzzles in this one, which is kind of new, but they're not anything that's going to, like, shake up your world. They're mostly just look for clues for, what's the word I'm looking for? Key
for
combinations
to
unlock. No, yeah, like combinations to unlock the door. So each door has like a keypad, if you will, and you have to find the clues to figure out what the combination is to get through the door. And that's pretty much like the greatest extent of the puzzles. You know, sometimes it will deviate and you'll have to actually find a physical key that will match the description of the door. Like one will have a heart emblem on it, so you need to find a key with a heart on the end. But otherwise, this is your throwback to Resident Evil, old school Resident Evil. We are talking tank controls. You do have the option between modern tank or classic I hate my life tank controls.
Wait, there's a difference? That was,
oh yeah. So like classic old school tank is basically you press left or right to spin your character and then forward or back to move them in the direction that you spun them to.
Yes.
Whereas modern tank actually lets you use the analog stick like you should use an analog stick.
Okay, I thought you were going to say that current, like, modern tank is where you use the forward and backward button on the directional pad, but you have to use L1 and R1 in order to turn and change direction.
Don't give them any ideas. I fully expect that to pop up as an option now.
We call that tank. Mega Man Legends controls.
Oh, God.
Yeah. That's let's see if we can make Eternal Cry tank mode. I really don't care for tank controls. I've gotten used to it in as far as the Outbreak games go, and of all three of them, this one is the most tolerable as far as the tank goes. Even though it's very similar, like it just feels like it's more responsive. There were options in the settings to, you know, adjust the controller dead zone and stuff, which helped. I was able just to set everything down so that I could spin in circles if I needed to, and it made life a lot easier because you can't even aim at the zombies, and then I shouldn't say zombies, there's different kinds of monsters and they're monstrosities. The term zombies doesn't get used in the game, but they're zombies. You can't even just like aim and walk while you're aiming. If you pull the left trigger to aim, she stands still. And
yeah, like old Resident Evil games.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's thank goodness for being able to set down the sensitivity because otherwise it would have went a lot worse for me. The whole point is basically just to get through this manor. And as you're doing so, you're going to uncover different types of little bits and pieces of the backstory. Kind of gives you a little more of an idea of how the outbreak happened, where it originated at, and just how this got to be the epidemic that it is. It really fills in the backstory. I don't want to give any spoilers away, but it really fills in the backstory that makes Outbreak so great. It's one of my favorite aspects of it. It's just that the story and the world building here is really, really rich. Even though it's tucked away inside of a game that can be kind of difficult to maneuver around in and is tough to learn. It's taken me 3 versions of this game to learn it. But I finally can maneuver it enough to get that backstory that is just really good. And I find that I enjoyed this one more than the other two combined and doubled. This version, not necessarily version, but this entry into the Outbreak series is way better. One of my previous complaints about the other Outbreak games too was that they were just incredibly shrouded in darkness. They were so poorly lit that you were just, it wasn't fair. The monstrosities were coming out at you left and right, and you couldn't even see them. We had no idea where anything was coming from. There's actually lighting in this house that you're in. And it's so nice that the game is actually lit up. You can see what's coming at you. You know what's, you can prepare yourself. And given the tank control nature and everything, it just works so much better. I'm sure there's probably somebody that's going to be like, yeah, she's just not a hardcore gamer and she can't do it. No, fuck off.
I would say that by definition, you were more a hardcore gamer than I will ever be. And I consider myself a pretty hardcore gamer.
I 1K'd this. That's how much I enjoyed this one over the predecessors. And I didn't hate the other ones. They were hard for me to get a handle on. And it's just not a gameplay mechanic, the whole tank control thing that I'm used to. And I did it. I 1K'd this one. I was so proud of myself.
You're just so stuck on those controls. Every time you talk about an Outbreak game, it just goes back to the controls.
I know. And it breaks my heart. It's the only thing I can fuss about because the story is so good. The first Outbreak game, I didn't care for the graphics. It was very pixelated. It was top down. The second one moved into the 3D realm and was an improvement, but it still had that just everything was fucking dark aspect.
Yeah.
And this one, it just feels like this one fixed everything I was mad about in the other two. And I just enjoyed it so much more. I do want to point out, though, that it is episodic and that this is just episode one and there are four more to come in the next year.
Do you think those will be DLC or free updates? Do we know anything on that yet? I don't think I heard anything.
It is DLC. I was looking on Steam to see what if they had an update schedule or anything on there for it. And the first episode is $4.99, or you can pay $14.99 on Steam for the whole game.
Ah, gotcha.
So I'm assuming it will be paid DLC time if you bought it and bought the complete edition. But I don't think Xbox had players had the option to buy a complete edition like that, or at least that's not the case with my code.
Yeah. I haven't seen anything about a complete edition either. I'm guessing maybe when the first episode is out, maybe we'll see a season pass for $10. Who knows?
That could be. That might be it, too. I didn't even think of it doing like a season pass. But, it's everything that I would normally complain about. It feels like it's been improved, and it was a much more enjoyable experience. And I'm really happy I played it.
Cool. So $5 for episode one. What is your verdict?
Buy it.
Okay.
Oh no, I had flashbacks because $5 for Star Wars Episode One in any form is not a good bargain.
Wrong Episode One, Steve-O.
Yeah.
I hate sand; it gets everywhere.
Sticking around for one more, Steve-O.
No, that's it. I am out.
Okay.
Play Outbreak.
I'm tempted to. I still need to beat Amnesia: The Dark Descent because that game is so scary that I have not been able to beat it.
Well, then go do that. That'll be your homework for next time you're on.
Oh no! I'll see you in a couple years, son. All right. Always a pleasure. Good to see both of you again. Have a great night.
Have a good one, Steve-O. All right. Next game to talk about is called MLB Home Run Derby VR, developed and published by Major League Baseball Advanced Media. It released April 26th on PlayStation VR and on Steam for Oculus and Vive for $19.99. Home Run, step into the diamond and crush it in the most immersive Home Run Derby VR game to date, presented by Major League Baseball. Feel the action and power of every swing with motion-based controls. Swing for the fences in the most authentic virtual reality MLB ballparks ever created. That explained the game. It is VR. So you put a headset on and you have, at least on PlayStation, you have a Move controller. And once you are in the game, there's a title screen and then you start the game and you are in the stadium. You are either in the Washington Nationals Stadium, Cleveland Indians, or the Miami Marlins. And, then you have a minute and a half to hit balls out of the park, and you get points based on how far your balls travel. You get a bonus if you hit a home run. If you hit multiple home runs in a row, you get a multiplier to it. So it's all about consistency in getting a good hit, a good solid connection with the ball, and sending it out of the stadium. You have a minute and a half to hit as many home runs as you can or score as many points as you can, and then you're done. And you can either hit the T button on the move controller to play again, or you can hang out for a couple of seconds and it kicks you back to the main menu. And then from there, you can play again. That's basically the whole game. I've been doing streams of a lot of the VR stuff that we get in. I'll do streams on Twitch, and I tweeted out, hey, I'm about to go live with Home Run Derby. And I think the stream lasted 15 minutes because there's not a lot to the game. It's a fairly tiny overall package on what's there. I wish there were more stadiums in the game. First off, only three stadiums is kind of a bummer. Like, I would have loved to be in Yankee Stadium, knocking them out, just because I hate the Yankees and I could have flipped off everybody in the crowd. And it would have been nice to have more modes in the game. I don't know what other modes you would put in a Home Run Derby game, because the whole point is just hit home runs. Maybe a longer duration of time, possibly.
So you can hit more balls.
Yeah, I really don't know what else you would add to this game besides more stadiums to be in. They have leaderboards. You could keep track of how well you're doing between left-handed, right-handed. They have a standard difficulty and then a professional difficulty, which I didn't bother with because I'm awful enough the way it is. I will say the game is a pretty solid workout. I was sweating my ass off after those first 15 minutes. I played a couple more times by myself later on. And, you know, I'm not that great at the game, but every now and then when I would actually hit a home run and watch it go out of the park, I would be thrilled. I'd be like, wow, I fucking hit a home run in Miami Marlins Stadium. I just nailed a 489-foot home run. Holy hell. It's a really, really cool experience for however much time you sink into it. It is fairly addictive. It's always that thought of one more round. Let me beat my high score. Let me see how many home runs I could get this time. Let me see if I could actually get a back-to-back home run in this. But it's fun. $20 is kind of steep for this given what's there, but if you're looking for a fun Home Run Derby game on PlayStation VR, I mean, there's not many other options. So $20, I give it a solid try. It's fun. It's something that you're going to bust out at parties and just have a good time with.
Is that the one where you messaged me and you were like, I'm about to go live, and then you messaged me right back and was like, never mind?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like 20 minutes later. I'm like, stream's over. I felt bad because there really wasn't that much to show off, given that there were only three stadiums. It was fun. It's really fun, really addictive. I just wish there was a bit more content-wise. Maybe they'll add more parks via DLC or via free updates. Who knows? But
that's a hefty price tag for just
VR
for like 15 minutes. Yeah,
it's VR. And this isn't something that you're going to spend 15 minutes on and never play again. This is like a quintessential party game. It's like, hey, want to bust out the VR and do something cool? Yeah, man. How about fucking Home Run Derby? Dude, that sounds awesome. Let's do it.
Is that how those conversations really go?
Kind of.
I don't have VR. I was just curious, and I don't ever have anybody come over. So.
When Chris came over, he was like, I asked if he wanted to try something in VR. He's like, dude, do you have Super Hot? I'm like, yeah. He's like, oh, I want to play Super Hot VR. So I base all my conversations around Chris and his reactions.
I'm not sure that's the best idea, Joe.
Dude, fucking dude, man. Oh my God. All right, tagging Cole out for a little bit. We're going to do some guest reviews because that's what we do on this show anymore. Jacob Garner, how are you doing?
I'm doing generally okay, provided my iPhone doesn't explode during this interview.
Why would it explode?
Well, so I've been having battery issues for a bit, and it got even worse with the latest iOS update. So I took it to the Apple store, and they're like, yeah, you've got a hardware failure imminent, so you should probably go buy a new iPhone because yesterday it was, you know, like if you leave it out in the sun too long, you can actually like heat up your phone to the point where like it won't operate correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was in my pocket, like walking around, like I was just like walking around the house, and apparently it was on that for 7 minutes, which the guy at the store was just like, yeah, that's not supposed to be a thing.
You are a train wreck waiting to happen, Jacob.
I know. So it looks like I'm going to have to get a new iPhone soon.
Nice. So video games, what do you think?
Eh, they're okay, I guess.
Well, you got three of them to talk about, so let's start things off with Super Mega Baseball 2, developed and published by Metalhead Software, released April 1st on Xbox One, PC, PS4 for $29.99, also a part of the Xbox Games with Gold program, which is pretty goddamn awesome. The critically acclaimed Super Mega Baseball series is back with gorgeous new visuals, deep team and league customization, long-awaited online multiplayer modes, accessible mechanics, deep skill curve, visceral pacing, lighthearted vibe, serious simulation. Jacob, tell us about Super Mega Baseball 2.
Well, that description's actually pretty apt to it. I mean, aside from the RBI baseball game that we reviewed about a month ago. Has it been a month?
Something like that.
Feels like it.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. So aside from that, like, I haven't had to play a baseball game in forever. So I fired it up a couple nights ago, and I'll be honest, right off the bat, I thought, like, great, this is just going to be like RBI again. I hate everything about this game. But I took the time to, like, start fiddling around with, you know, how the game works and all that other kind of stuff. I love it. I can't stop playing this game now. Like, I couldn't, like, Jess can tell you, like, I was swearing at the TV, like, you know, like, oh, this thing, like, that should have been a home run. Like, this pitching mechanic sucks, blah, 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 blah. By 2 a.m., like, I was just like, this is the best thing ever. I'm not going to stop playing. Like, I've already set up a season that, like, I'm, like, kicking complete ass at, because seeing as I'm terrible at these kind of games, I've set it to, like, what the game considers to be an easy mode. And so, like, I'm rocking, like, you know, at least 3 home runs, everything. But, like, I'm just getting in, like, a mess of RBIs. And so all my opponents, like, lose, like, 17-0. And
17-0, bitch. You got to step your game up.
I know the game is supposed to be played, like, you know, to be a bit of a challenge, but I'm having a blast with it.
That's the beauty. The game doesn't have to be set up to be a challenge. There are legitimately 100 difficulty settings in the game. They have the ego mode, which you could basically customize the game to however difficult you want it to be, ranked from 0 to 99. And if you're playing at 99, you got some balls on you, man.
Right, and I think there's actually achievements attached to the 99 one. But the game starts you off at about 15, which is a little bit of a challenge. like, shut up, Joe, whatever. Anyway, I knocked it down to 0. But, like, the thing was is that it also helped me learn, like, the mechanics of the game. With hit, like, I still don't quite get hitting, like, the power swing. So I don't quite... What?
I can't get over the fact that you think 15 is hard. It's a bit of a challenge. Dude, I was winning games 48-8.
I haven't fired it back up since then, so maybe at this point I'd be fine with it.
Maybe. Yeah.
But,
I won a game 48-8 earlier on 15, and it's because I got bored near the end and I wanted to stop winning so much, so I bumped the difficulty up. And I was just like, let's end this game. It's been almost an hour.
I don't know.
You're just bad at games.
Well, that's fair. I mean, like, we pretty much admit that every single show I'm on, but yeah,
true.
At this point, I'm having a blast with it.
Yeah, so. The game is absolutely fantastic. We covered the first game back when it launched a couple of years back. Loved it then, and I love pretty much everything they did with this new version, including the ungodly in-depth character and team customization options that they have in this game.
Honestly, that was one of the other things too, because they're not based on like real life baseball teams, like I didn't have any idea like what I was supposed to be doing with them. But then what is it? Like there's like 20 teams that you can choose from, 2024, somewhere around there.
There's a bunch. A lot more than the first game.
And it gives you descriptions as to like, oh well, this is how they play on every other thing. And so you know, if you're really just looking to like have a good time and just like whack some baseballs and like, you know, win every single game, it tells you, all right, this team's the power hitters and all this other kind of stuff. And so if you have a certain play style, they'll have a team that's already pre-made and it matches what, you know, what you need to do to be able to win. And so I just really, like, I loved that feature, like, because that was one of the things that, like, once I figured that part out, it made the game a lot more fun for me.
Yeah. I'm talking about the customization, though, where the people who don't just want to settle for a pre-made team, you can have absolute complete control over your entire team. You could create the name, the logo, the characters. You could rename every single character. You could readjust the stats for every single character. If you want to be an asshole and have a team of all the players being 99 in every stat, you could do that and just be an asshole like me.
I think there's an achievement for that too.
There's one for setting one player to all 99s.
Oh yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was looking through the achievements last night, but
in terms of season, you could do the standard seasons and the standard playoff modes that they have in the game, or you could create your own leagues in the game. I'm blown away by the amount of customization in this game.
Yeah, it's really well done, and it's a lot of fun. It's a lot more than I was expecting it to be.
And thankfully, I did a little bit of time with the beta, and one of the things that seemed to be somewhat lacking in the beta was some of the trademark humor from the first game, and it looks like they did tweak that a bit. I hear the funnier umpires a lot more frequently. I've seen a handful of times where you peg a batter in the head and they just drop like a brick. It's fantastic.
I've hit pitchers a few times. Yeah, I'm surprised by that.
Oh my God, the first time it's so fucking cool. Yeah, I recorded a clip.
Although I was a little surprised. If you hit him in the chest, nothing happens. You have to whack him in the head.
Mm-hmm.
So
decapitate a son of a bitch.
Yeah, I was hoping to take out more people, but, you know, this is baseball, not Grand Theft Auto.
Very true.
The only things that, like, you know, now that, like, I found my groove with the game and, you know, I'm really digging it, the only things that I don't, like, really like about it is that, first off, there's no real home run derby mode like RBI has,
mm-hmm.
Which is a lot of, like, for me, that's a lot of fun, and I still play the home run derby mode in RBI. Like, that's actually the only part of the game I still play. But the other thing is that I don't really like how there's no, like, tutorial mode or, like, a batting cage mode where, like, so you can just, like, figure out how to hit stuff. Yeah. Like, both RBI and this game have the issues where it's just, like, you have to fire up an exhibition game and you're going to suck while you try figuring stuff out. Like, there's no practice. Like, there's no real practice mode to these games.
Yeah, and but at least they have the tutorial pop-ups while you're playing. Some of them could be a bit more timely, sure.
Yeah, because some of them don't pop up until after, like, the events already occurred. It's like, oh, you should have stolen that base. Well, let's teach you how to do it.
Yeah,
like,
pretty much.
Thanks, that doesn't help.
Although, on the bright side, at least it doesn't hammer you menu and, like, tutorial and tutorial and tutorial one after another, and you're just like, I want to play the goddamn game.
Yeah, like, you can tell the tutorial is immediately go away, yeah. Which is pretty nice. But, as I said, I wish there was, like, a real, like, a true practice mode for this game. But, otherwise, like, I'm loving it. This is fantastic.
Cool. So, $30, your decision on this one for,
I thought you said it was $25.
$29.99.
Oh, okay. Yeah, totally. I mean, heck, you get it for free right now on Xbox Live, but, you know, if you have to buy it because for some reason you're slow, absolutely.
I agree. It is an absolute blast. It is everything I had hoped that the sequel would be. I do kind of miss the super deformed character look from the first game, but I kind of understand why they wanted to go with a more realistic look. I agree. I think having a home run derby mode would be really cool. Maybe we'll see that come down the line. They are doing a little bit of stuff with downloadable content where they have character customization packs that you could buy. It's clearly nothing required. It's just if you want more character creation options, you can get them if you want. But other than that, fantastic game, and props to Metalhead for giving Xbox gamers a good baseball game.
Yeah, definitely.
But next game to talk about is called Shantae Half Genie Hero Ultimate Edition, developed and published by WayForward. It is out May 8th on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $29.99. A massive collection that's packed to the gills. Shantae fans and newcomers alike will treasure this all-inclusive Ultimate Edition of Shantae Half Genie Hero. Jacob, tell us about this one.
So it's very much like an old-school platforming game. You play this woman who... obviously she's half genie. Sorry, I had to burp. Weird. So anyways, you get all these different, like, you have these powers. The first one that you get is, like, related to your hair, and you can use it as, like, a whip to destroy enemies and stuff like that. But as you go through the game, you can get different powers that help you to do various things. And, of course, you have to go back to levels you previously played, so you can go through them and unlock stuff that you didn't get before. But pretty much the whole game is that you have to defend this town called Scuttletown from this attack from this pirate, Risky Boots, I believe is her name. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the first game in the whole series I've ever played.
So. Really, dude, yeah. You are missing out on some shit.
Yeah. I know. I'm a big fan of this game. I really enjoyed it. Spoiler for my review. But so your uncle's making this machine, and you have to, like, go around the world and, like, get all these parts for him. And should I keep describing the plot, or is that, like, going into spoiler territory?
You're probably getting into spoiler territory. You got to save the town.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, you have to save the town. And save the
world.
I
would hope most
of
our audience knows the plot of the Shantae games, given how much we've covered them. So the main question here is, how much content is in this Ultimate Edition of the game?
Holy crap. I mean, I'm assuming that this is far more than the original version, but they include a lot of stuff. There are new out... you obviously get the new outfits with it, but there's extended DLC which offer new levels. One of them is from the point of view of Risky Boots, where she gets to explain why she did what she did. There's another one that's like an alternate universe kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't exactly know how to describe it. I think it's more like, you know, if something hadn't occurred, then, like, this is how it would be or something like that. And then there's this thing called the Costume Pack DLC, which gives Shantae, like, at least three different new outfits, and each one of them has their own little mission that goes along with it. Like, one of them, she's, like, a ninja, and she can throw ninja stars.
Yeah, another one, we covered, like, the Costume DLC, like, a week or two ago. Well, it might have been a bit longer than that, but I know we covered the Costume DLC fairly recently.
Oh, okay. Well, then, oh. Well,
so basically, this is the game that everybody knows and loves, with all of the DLC all smashed together in one convenient package.
And yeah, and from what I've read, if it also includes the Kickstarter backer stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So if you missed out on it the first time, this is how you get it, which is pretty neat.
Yeah, the Tinkerbat dance.
Right, and I've seen the day one editions that the Nintendo Switch and PS4 got. They look pretty sweet. With those, you get a art book and a soundtrack CD.
Yeah, it makes me sad that Microsoft is so strict with their print run limits on games and keeps a bunch of cool collector editions from showing up.
Oh, that's disappointing, because honestly, like, the art book's pretty great, and, I mean, I really enjoyed the music, which is done by Jake Kaufman.
Mm-hmm.
Who I got to meet at MAGFest that one time I went.
Yeah, you should go more often.
I keep saying that, but at this point, the crowd that thing draws, holy crap, I wouldn't be able to handle that.
You can handle
that. That's way too many people.
Suck it up, pussy. So, massive package, $30 on this one. As a brand new Shantae fan, what do you think of it?
Absolutely, like, this is a definite buy. Like, you should have this in your video game library, whether you have a PlayStation, Xbox, or a Nintendo Switch. It's really well made. The graphics are gorgeous. Jake's music is great. Everything about this game is an absolute knockout. And so you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't get the Ultimate Edition, if you haven't already bought everything beforehand.
Yeah, I could say from experience, if you already own Half Genie Hero and all the DLC, you really don't need the Ultimate Edition. But if you're a fan of trophies and achievements, it's a whole new achievement list for people to have fun with.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, boy. But you got one final game to talk about, and that is called Cubix Paint, published May 10th on iOS by AB Light Productions for $3.99. With Cubix Paint, you will be able to sculpt the hidden models in order to paint them and many more things. Let your imagination fly or follow the coloring patterns ideal for the younger players in order to develop their visual and spatial abilities while they have fun playing with Cubix. Everyone will have fun painting with their children wherever they are. Jacob, what do you think of Cubix Paint?
It's an interesting little game. So what it is that you get this 3D cube, and you're supposed to chip away by tapping your phone screen, and underneath it'll reveal like a sculpture of like some sort of animal, like a dog or a cat or a bird, all that other kind of stuff. And you have to be very careful not to hit the sculpture, and you start losing health if that's the case. And if you lose too much, then you have to start all over again. I can imagine that this is more fun on an iPad than an iPhone, but the game does allow you to blow up the screen a bit just so, you know, you can get those precise taps in. And then afterwards, you're given the chance to paint it if you want to, which it becomes kind of like a paint-by-numbers game, which I don't know. It's a neat feature. It doesn't really seem to do anything for the models other than it like puts a wreath around it on the model select screen.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's a nice activity and it's definitely a decent time killer. I had more fun with the like chipping away at the sculpture thing, yeah, more so than the paint. The paint was a little tedious, but you know, all in all, I thought it was fun. I think it retails for what, like $3-4, I think?
$4, $3.99.
Yeah, $4. It's definitely fun. I'd recommend checking it out. There is an AR feature to it, but I don't know. To me, it felt kind of forced and a little unnecessary. But, you know, if you're all about, you know, the AR features for iPhone games nowadays, then have at it, but I didn't really see the point to it.
Well, I will take your word for it, since you are the pro when it comes to all things useless and unnecessary. Jacob, but it's always good having you on chatting about this. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, because I think I've reviewed games by Abbey Light before, because they did the RC car game, right?
Mm-hmm. And you're going to have another one coming up soon, too.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, this one I actually preferred of their games. I mean, both of the games that I've had to play for them were fairly solid, but this one I felt was far more enjoyable and more intuitive than the RC car one. That one, I feel like the technology's not really there for it, but this one, it's definitely all ages. Anyone can grasp it. I'd recommend checking it out.
Cool. Sounds good. Anything else?
I don't know. I mean, I could start talking about other things just to annoy you.
No, then I'll just do the spiel. Jacob, always good having you on chat about this stuff. Do you have any final thoughts before we send it back to me and Cole with the rest of the reviews?
No, not really. I'm looking forward to going back to playing more baseball now.
Cool. Burn in hell.
All right. Fuck off.
All right, next game to talk about is called Drago Dino, developed by Teal Rock Studio, published by Plug-In Digital, released April 27th on Xbox One and Switch for $9.99. Meet Bob, a cute Drago Dino, and guide him through 10 levels of the Forest Kingdom in a quest to recover his lost egg stuck atop a giant tree. Fight your way to the top in Drago Dino, an epic adventure set in an ever-changing world. Cole, what is Drago Dino?
Drago Dino is a platformer. It's not exactly an overwhelmingly difficult platformer. It's just a vertical platformer. Like, what was that? You didn't hear it?
No.
Oh, I don't know what it was then. I thought Skype did a thing, but I guess not.
I don't know what we're talking about.
Try that again. Gecko Dino is a vertical platformer. It's not overwhelmingly difficult, but it is just you trying to get your dinosaur up the tree in the forest and retrieve his egg. There's apparently a whole new species of dinosaurs that evolved after a meteor hit the planet and created these little offshoot islands in the sky. I think it was Scassoria is how you pronounce it, is the name of the islands in the sky that they live on. And so they've evolved into these Drago dinos, and the eggs are incredibly rare. Like, it's not something that happens often. So when one gets stolen, it's a huge, big ordeal, which means Bob has to go catch it, you know, find his kid. It's like God of War, but with less mythology.
Yeah, I see all the parallels to God of War with this game.
I don't know. It's Dad of War with Drago Dinos.
Drago War.
Yeah. That has a whole different connotation in my head. Now I see Kratos with like a wig and pink makeup.
I look fabulous.
Boy, girl.
Anyway.
Sorry.
Collect anyway, yourself. Collect yourself.
Go save your egg at the top of the forest. The whole story sets up around the fact that you're supposed to be Bob going to save the egg, but it actually does give you the option to choose between Bob or Lola when you start playing. Bob looks more like a T-Rex with wings, whereas Lola looks more like a Triceratops with wings. There are some minor differences between the two. Lola can take an extra hit. She has 4 health points, whereas Bob only has 3. But she moves a little slower. Once you actually start a level, you have various enemies around the section. Each level is broke down into, I think it's 5 sections? 4 or 5 sections. And you have to collect diamonds as you move up. Once you have all the diamonds in one section, you can move on to the next. A platform opens up to take you up. You have basic, you know, platforming abilities of run and jump. However, once you collect a diamond from an enemy, you can then power jump, which lets you go a little higher. The more diamonds,
obviously, the more diamonds, the higher you go.
The higher you can jump. So that's kind of the big mechanic, is just figure out how to get your diamonds so that you can really get to where you want to go. The one shocking thing about this as a platformer is that it's also a roguelite. So when you die, you're done. You're starting all over. Good luck. There are 2 modes. You can play normal or hardcore. Normal does give you 3 lives. Hardcore you get 1 shot.
Yeah.
But even with normal and it giving you 3 lives, you still get started at the very beginning of your level, and you've lost all of your power-ups, any specials you've picked up along the way, any coins that you'd earned, any bonuses that you'd unlocked, it's all gone. So if you die, that's that. Which is problematic.
I was going to say, it is soul-crushing when you die in this game and you've got to start back over.
It's magnified when you're playing co-op.
How?
So when you're playing co-op, it's split-screen, obviously. There's no online, so it's just split-screen. The game gives the 2 characters the ability to explore separately from one another. There's no tether. They're not required to be in the same scene. One can continue to go up as soon as they've got the diamonds, whereas the other can stay, you know, lower or go higher or whatever and look for collectibles. If one of you gets knocked out, you have 9 seconds to find your ally and revive them.
9
seconds.
Oh God.
There is no map. And there is no indicator as to where they are.
Oh, God.
And if they die, you both die.
Oh, you cannot continue
without your ally. And it is incredibly infuriating. I've played split screen with my husband, and God love him. Every time he died, I just put the controller down and walked away.
Oh, God.
I gave up.
See, I didn't do any co-op stuff, but I did play solo, and I will say it is soul-crushing to spend 20 minutes on a stage getting right near the very end and dying and having to lose all of that progress. I wish, you know, if you're playing on normal where you have multiple lives, I wish the game at least treated each of the different areas that you move to as a checkpoint. That I think that would immensely improve the experience of this game, because I'm having fun with it. I'm enjoying it. It is cute. It is fun, but it is just soul crushing every time you die and lose so much progress.
I think that that's made worse too by the fact that this is kind of marketed as being a kid-friendly platformer.
Yeah.
And so, like, it never really feels like it's kid-friendly. Like, when you're taking on the enemies and stuff, you're like, this is easy, derp, derp, derp. And it's usually something mundane or ridiculous that results in you dying anyway, and you're just like, what? But it's made worse by if you're playing with a kid and they die, you're automatically getting started at the beginning too. If you're playing co-op, or, you know, you see kids who will spend an insane amount of time going over every type of area, trying to get every collectible, and then they just drop on an enemy they couldn't see because it was below them or something like that, and have to start all over again. Yeah. It's infuriating. And then if you're at a boss fight, and there's three boss fights, if you're at a boss fight and you die, you start that whole level again. You do not checkpoint back to right before the boss. You start everything over again.
Oh, Lord.
There's just no break. And it's such a sharp turn in difficulty for something that should, for all intents and purposes, be kid-friendly.
Yeah.
Number three was playing with me. And, you know, she's five. She's not really, you know, capable of doing the whole cooperative aspect, but she's not bad at platformers. This is a five-year-old who knows how to play Super Meat Boy.
Oh, God.
So she can manage a platformer, but at the same time, like, we were just getting thrown back for ridiculous stuff because she's five, and most of the game was tolerable for her until it just randomly would spike in difficulty.
And I mean, I'm 37 and I died in the game, and I still, like, wanted to cry every time it happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And she eventually just got to where she's like, I'm not getting anywhere. I'm going to go play cars or something. I don't even remember what she ditched me for. And I was like, you don't even want to play with me? No. Okay.
I'm thinking this is a case of one of those things where the people who made the game got so used to playing it that they didn't realize how difficult it became.
Yeah. At the same time, though, like, if I'm not mistaken, there's an achievement for getting through the whole game in one life.
Yeah, fuck that.
Yeah, and I fully expect that to be one of those that's on TA with, like, a 75 ratio, some nonsense. It's going to be insane.
Well, like, all that,
I can't even properly math it. That's how weird it's going to be.
All that said, $10 on this one. What do you think?
I do give it a try, especially if you like a challenge. But if you're buying it with kids in mind, if you think you're going to be split-screening it with a kid, make sure that they're able to find you when you die, or that you can find them. Like, keep your
eyes. Buddy system. Stay close together.
But, yeah. Safety in numbers.
I agree. I give it a try as well. I hope this is one of those games that they go back and fine-tune it and rebalance it, though. Because yeah. I think this could be a lot better of a game if it was just balanced properly. It's like Corgan all over again, where it's just more difficult than it should be.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense for it to be that hard.
Yeah. Anyway, next game is called Survive Mr. Cube, developed and published by Intra Games. It released April 26th on PS4 for $14.99. Mr. Cube is destined to find another self on the parallel universe to live his original life, waking up in this unknown dimension. The only thing that in hands is a weapon and my body. There could be a way to escape over the dimension gate, but the dangerous monsters blocks from moving forward. I love write-ups that are...
Are you drunk?
No, I love write-ups that are like that. It just makes me smile when you could tell that English isn't their primary language. But damn it, they try, and it's awesome, and I love it. Survive Mr. Cube is kind of like an isometric viewed action-adventure roguelite, where you start a game, you died, and you wake up in a camp area, and you have to venture out and find your way back to your original life and get out of the afterlife. You go through a portal, you are in a wooded area, or, you know, later in the game, you'll go to like desert areas, different areas that you go through. You have to search the area that you're in. All of them are randomly generated. You have to look for a tower that once you defeat the tower, it creates a portal to another area. There you'll eventually make your way to a boss area. If you follow the path correctly, you could also run into a dead end and then have to backtrack quite a bit, which I've had to do a few times. Once you get to the boss, you kill the boss and move on and just keep playing. if you die, you basically start back over with a whole new person, new starting weapon. You can examine the grave of the previous Mr. Cube, and sometimes you get a little bonus from there. Or any money that you have earned from your previous trip, you'll be able to spend on the little merchant dude who's hanging out there that will sell you items, whether they're power-ups, or usually you'll just get different weapons in the game. A lot of different weapons that you can experience in the game. I will say now, if you find a gun, you immediately have easy mode, and the game becomes a lot easier to play through. My first couple of runs, I had like a spear, I had a shield that you could shield bash people with, I had swords. As soon as I got the gun, that was the playthrough that I beat the game. It just became so much easier. I had like a shotgun blast, and every enemy that would come near me, I would like one shot the thing almost. It worked.
Wow.
Fucking awesome. I loved it. One of the big draws with this game, I'll say right now, this is a trophy machine for PlayStation gamers who love their trophies. Not only does this have a lot of trophies with it, so you're constantly earning trophies, it has a platinum trophy, and it is one of the easiest platinums I've experienced in a PlayStation game. I platinumed it in like a day, if that.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really easy to get through. A really fun, enjoyable game. I'm always a fan of roguelites where the game is constantly changing, so it's never the same experience every time you play. The combat felt good. I kind of wish the character moved a little bit faster, but they do have... They do have power-up potions that you can get that allow you to either move faster, they'll heal your health, they'll heal your stamina, they'll make you stronger. The agility potions to move around quicker, I would find myself hoarding those just so I could explore the different areas a bit quicker. You're never going to be in short supply of potions for the most part. There's treasure chests everywhere. It just comes down to what is in the chests and what type of potions you get. I guarantee if you're running low on health, you're going to get anything but a health potion. But if you're full on health, you're going to see plenty of health potions. So just stockpile them. You could hold up to 4 potions at a time. I usually would hold 2 health potions, a stamina potion, and an agility potion. And if you open a chest and there's a new agility potion there, pop the one that you have and pick up the new one and just continue on with the game. There's not a super amount of depth to it. It's just really fun, really enjoyable, easy trophies, and it's addictive. I love games that you can just sit down and play for either 10 minutes or an hour, and you just keep thinking, let me do one more run. Kind of like Home Run Derby. Yeah. You just want to do one more run. $15 is a smidge on the high side price-wise, but it's still enjoyable, so I give it a solid try it.
Sounds good.
Next game is actually some DLC to talk about. X-Morph Defense European Assault DLC, developed and published by Exor Studios. Game originally released last August for $19.99. European Assault DLC released March 26th for $4.99. This add-on includes a new story-driven mini-campaign happening on the European front. The action takes place parallel to the main story campaign and focuses on European military forces trying to repel the X-Morph invasion, wreak havoc across Finland and Holland before concluding in an epic destruction-fueled showdown at the Eiffel Tower in France. Cole, tell us about this DLC.
Holy balls, this DLC is insane. Absolutely insane. I had not played X-Morph up until you gave me this for review. And so I had to like start the whole campaign. And I got to a point where I was like, well, campaign's kind of tough, but I'm going to hop over and do the DLC just because that's what I'm supposed to review anyway, right? The DLC on Very Easy was incredibly frantic. And then I went back to the main campaign after I beat the DLC. And I was just sitting there like, this is so easy. Why was I struggling? There are new weapons involved, both on the alien side and on the human side, that dramatically change the way that the game plays. It's kind of a shock that these had to be like crammed into DLC. I think they would have been fantastic as part of the main campaign missions. In DLC, though, it kind of feels like it's just like an onslaught of, okay, you're in Finland. Here's three new weapons the humans have created against you. Deal with them. Okay, you're in Holland. Here's three new weapons the humans have created. Deal with them. and it's like, boy, it would have been nice if those were a little more spread out. Like in the main campaign, you play a couple of levels. The humans get new tech against you. That's a boss battle. So it feels like instead, like the DLC is like three waves of boss battles, just constant. Okay, they've got a new weapon. It's been 15 minutes, two waves, time for another weapon. And it's just very fast-paced. It just feels different when compared to the main campaign. It's not bad in any way. The weapons that humans come up with against the X-Morphs is just incredible. And the way that you have to reimagine how you've played the game to get around those weapons. I don't want to give spoilers on the weapons is what I'm trying to do. The way you have to reimagine how to play the game is really incredible. It adds a whole lot of depth and it gives you something to keep going back to and fighting against. Unless you're like me and you play on very easy mode to make life easier for you. because I don't want to get smashed by weapons immediately. Joe?
Yeah.
Okay. You were very quiet.
I'm sitting here nodding my head and agreeing.
That doesn't help me.
So a lot more frantic, a lot more crazy.
But
cool new weapons.
Incredibly well done. Yeah, it is incredibly well done. I do wish there were just more than the three missions. Again, it just feels like it's all just kind of crammed into three sets really quickly, and I would have liked to have seen it spread out a little more. No. But the whole concept of turning the Eiffel Tower into a weapon and just, you know, if the humans lose it, it's a huge morale drop, and it was just incredible. There was a lot of weight to it, like, which side is going to make it? Obviously, in X-Morph, you're playing as the aliens. And so, like, you're just like, I'm going to crush all the humans' hopes and dreams.
Makes sense.
And you own morale boosts against them. So it was a lot of fun, though. I really did enjoy it.
So you also played the full game for the first time. So I want to know, first off, $20 on the full game, what do you think? Because we gave it a buy it previously.
I stick with a buy it. I really do. I didn't think that X-Morph was the kind of game that I would like to play. I'm not much of a tower defense fan. And a lot of times I'm just like, okay, there's a place and I can't let things get to it. But I enjoyed the strategy aspect of X-Morph enough that it just made it different. And the whole fact that you could play it, if you were playing on Super Pussy Crybaby mode like I did... You didn't have to stress about the tower defense side of it. you could just fly around and shoot shit and be happy. And I did. And I would set up a tower whenever it made me, but otherwise I was just like, I'm going to blow up everything.
Nice.
And you can do that. And so the fact that I didn't have to play it like a tower defense if I didn't want to was the greatest thing about it. And it's visually insane. I didn't expect all that from it visually. There were a few moments where I was like, this is a little Halo Wars-ish. I'm waiting for a brute chieftain to come running out here.
Cool. So Xmorph keeps its buy it rating. DLC, mm-hmm. European Assault DLC, $5. What is your verdict on that?
Definitely gets a buy it as well. If you're gonna, you know, enjoy the game, and if you've played it and you've had fun with it and you just wish there was a little more, there's a shit ton of levels there already. But if you'd like a little more, or you just want to fuck up the humans with the Eiffel Tower, you should definitely pay $5 and buy it.
And I already did, because I thought the full game was amazing, and I can't wait to play more. I really need to sit down and play the DLC.
I am working on cleaning up some of the achievements, because the achievements are insane. They're like, destroy 17,500 ground troops. And I'm like, okay.
Good Lord.
That's a lot of humans.
That is a lot of humans.
I also made my husband play co-op with me on that. He's not good at that either.
He's only good at farming and mud running.
Basically.
Nice. Oh, man. Well, we are going to call it the end of this episode. It has been a long one. Between Andrew, AJ chatting about City of Brass with us, Steve-O coming around and showing off his body pillow, anime waifu. And every time he comes on, he just throws...
The show after the fact won't even get to see the waifu.
Oh, I know. I should just have him take a picture of it and have that as the picture for the episode.
Just the thumbnail.
No, I like having the show on YouTube still. I don't want to get it booted because of that. But yeah, that is it for this episode. Thanks everyone for hanging out and listening. Cole, do you have any final words to end the show?
Go read that New York Times article though, so you can be mad.
You